and Jap gunboat passed our camp, aided by two tugs. She had sustained some damage, a hit on the crow's nest, plainly visible. Four suspected cases of diphtheria sent to Bone Road. At dinner, we tackled our first fresh fruit in 7 months. Each man had half of a Chinese pear, a dry, woody fruit about the size of a turkey's egg. August 18th, a sergeant struck a private and then laid a charge of slander against him dated October the 25th, 41. The camp was wild with indignation when the private was given 14 days' detention. August 19th, raining. By noon, the wind had risen to a gale-like proportion. The harbor very rough. Fishing fleet come in. Spray from the breakers flying over our huts. A wild, stormy night. Huts shaking in the blast. August 20th. Wind dropped. Fishing fleet went out again. Cloudy and cool. After our usual morning roll call, which we had a second. And then a muster out in the square, which kept us out there until 2:30. Four men escaped last night. Sergeant Payne, Corporal Brzezinski, Percy Ellis, from Wawanisa, and Tiger Adams from Winnipeg. He was in the band. They are supposed to have had in their possession a gun, a compass, and a map, and some canned foodstuffs. Where they could get, we can't imagine. They climbed over the hospital instead of going through the fence. Now the Japs are putting rolls of concertina wire along the ridgepole of the hospital. We suppose the four men intend to cross to the mainland, take the hills, sleep by day, travel to friendly territory before being caught. The Jap officers are giving Nick, George's brother, a hard time, beating and cross-examining him. They think he ought to know something about his brother's escape. August 21st, new orders up announce that the Japs warn anyone escaping that they expose themselves to risk of death. August 23rd, the sentries are vigilant since the escape and screech and howl at one another all night long. One of our officers and a sergeant make regular rounds looking for disturbances, and some of our own men are detailed to guard our own hut for suspicious movements of our own men. August 25th, one of our men got 7 days' detention because he refused to sit up at night and watch for and report any possible escapes. In the evening, Dick Trick, Milton Dan, Jack Hay, and myself sit around and talk farming from all conceivable angles. A lot of men are troubled with so-called electric feet, almost impossible to describe, must be felt to be appreciated. A terrible thing, but just another symptom of diet deficiency. Right now, one of our sergeants, Sergeant Webster, is delirious with the pain. Some men came back from Bone Road. They brought the news of the death of Lucas and Jim Chapman. The latter died on the 14th and buried on the 15th. One of the sad things that has happened, he had quinsy and dysentery, was a married man with four children. Chapman was always so optimistic, so enthusiastic. His booming voice and his hearty laugh were known all over the camp. Too generous for his own good, he enjoyed life and just living so well. It was hard to believe he had given it all up for something better. He had lost a lot of weight and used to say it would be a labor of love to put it all on again. August the 28th, CSM Logan and CSM Adams and Staff Sergeant McNaughton were taken out of camp to be questioned by the Japs regarding the escape. Logan is sick, a 10C. McNaughton is an old man, a veteran of the First War, with white hair. Adams is just out of hospital. Today the Rifles had date pie with a crust made with peanut oil, yet we get neither oil, pie, nor dates, yet all supplies are shared evenly between the two units. We cannot help but wonder sometimes. August 29th, we had got nicely to sleep when the lights went on. Our officers entered, robbed us, and called the roll, then left. And we were just asleep again when the lights went on again, and six Jap officers came in and made a bed check. Then we were ordered out on the parade square, regular muster in alphabetical order. A heavy, cold rain began to fall. We had no time to dress. We were either in the remains of pajamas or ragged underwear. We were soaked in minutes. We stood shivering in the wind and rain and darkness for 4.5 hours while the Japs counted and recounted and searched and researched hunts. They are in an ugly mood and strike and struck quite a number of us as we covered off and numbered in the ranks. We had to learn to number off in Japanese. Ichi ni san shi go roku shi chi hachi ku ju. And there were some of the French Canadians who could not master the counting, and they would fight to get them in the rear rank. And anyone who could count Japanese was just automatically just forced in the front rank. August the 30th. This evening, the three hostages came back. They had had no beds, had not undressed, had practically nothing to eat since they left. C.S.M. Logan has been quite ill all the time. September 1st, 42, two rifles died, one with dysentery, one with hiccough. He started hiccuping and he couldn't stop, and it interfered with his breathing, and he just choked eventually. I will have to give up breathing altogether, I am afraid, as my eyes are giving me a lot of trouble. At the instigation of Dr. Crawford, the Japs are docking the officer's pay and raising a fund to buy a few extra rations for the men who are far below average in weight. September 2nd, a Jap officer came in the hut today and told Nick his brother had been captured the same day he escaped. We have reason to believe that the four who got out were all killed. We have good reason to believe they were caught and killed. September 3rd. The hut guard last night was found asleep, and he's up on orders this morning. September 4th. Our buns are getting smaller all the time. September 5th, 42. More men are getting the terrible pains in their feet and hobble around on their heels to keep their toes off the ground. They can't sleep at night with the queer electric shocks that run through them. September 6th, 42. Twice a day I draw potassium permanganate for a queer rash on my legs called pellagra. It seems to be getting worse all the time. You'd see a spot here and there of pus just under the skin. And in the middle of the night, you'd get a terrible itching. And you'd, in the middle of the night, instinctively, in your sleep, you'd start clawing your legs. Then the pus pockets would break, and then it would spread. And it would spread, it would keep spreading. Twice a day I draw pot for manganate for a queer rash in my legs called pellagra. It seems to be getting worse all the time. The doc says it's all caused by diet deficiency. Talking to Bug Winram from Pilot Mound and the Curry brothers about Rock Lake. They used to live near there. September the 8th, about 20 men took after a rat today. A Japanese, part of the Dutch sub-crew, finally killed it with a shovel. The Jap sentries now wear a white cotton pad over their nose and mouth, supposed to check the spread of colds, or is it protection against what we have? Now, 40 of our men have been issued with them. A report came in that 130 POWs have died at Champchipole. And 7 killed trying to escape. R.T. Johnson has gone to Bowen Road with throat trouble and foot rot. September the 9th. The Japs went through all the huts and seized all the tools, all the iron, steel and wood, canes, running shoes, and rain capes. Today, all men are issued with bits of cotton gauze in order to wear it over the nose and mouth. Tonight, we heard that Lance Corporal Whillier died at Bowen Road with ulcers in his mouth and throat. He was a very fine fellow, was in the artillery with Victor Hart in the last war. September 11th, Japs still salvaging in the harbor with a fleet of tugs. Bill Harkness sent to Bowen Road today. He really missed Jim Chapman. September 12th, Rocky Smith died in the camp hospital here during the night. He was an old grenadier, very short, and before he was captured, he was quite stout.
Some of he come and dug his grave this morning across the road in the rocky hillside.
Only dug 3.5 feet and they struck solid rock. Buried it 2 o'clock. He had dysentery, fever, throat trouble, and malnutrition. September 15th. My eyes are very sore. Many men have the same thing. Nothing for it but potassium permanganate, which doesn't seem to help. September 17th. Old Dave Johnson talking about the Pipestone Valley. He worked for Jeffrey Lothian for Tom Fort before he enlisted in the war of 1418. September 20th. Reports that 500 Imperials from Shamshipo have been sent to Japan and 1,200 more to follow. The weather is gradually turning cooler, especially at night. September 21st. Everyone is suffering from skin trouble. Your face is cracked and peeling, rash across the shoulders. Heard today that Doug Moore, Hawks, and Harkness had died at Bowen Road. Old Bill and Chapman will be together again. They were great pals. They haven't been separated for very long, after all. September the 23rd, clearing all the dysentery cases out of camp. Also, C, bed down. Sending off to Bornoid. Tonight, each man got an ounce issue of what they call liquid yeast. Just a sour, sticky mouthful resembling flour and water. September 24th, a large number booked for Bone Road have been canceled by Yap order. 145 grenadiers and 133 rifles are getting the thiamin needle every day at the MI hut. All have swollen, sore and swollen feet. A rumor we're moving to the mainland. September the 27th, 5 ounces of yeast, 8 ounces of bread daily. More rice here than North Point. 2 isolation hospitals here, 1 for diphtheria, 1 for dysentery. 3 funerals today for the Imperials, weather hot and clear. September 28th, every available man being grabbed for work party at the airport. No hot water available in camp. Since the 13th of this month, they have been from 1 to 3 deaths every day in this camp. But the Japs want 640 men for work tomorrow. September 29th. All men with bad feet are being taken out of hospital, and the fever patients are being put in their place. An Imperial corporal told me of the 400 here, 50 had escaped, 115 died, 30 in this last month. Now 1,600 have left on a draft for Japan, and our 1,400 from North Point are over here. A double funeral today, a rifle and a Navy man. September 30th, every man was issued with a plug of tobacco, the cheapest and vilest stuff imaginable. Corporal Ivarov of B Company died last night with diphtheria. He was from Isabella, Manitoba. A very fine fellow. October 1st. I am helping a little with the library tonight. A regular gale and heavy rain. The guards are firing all night through intervals of from 3 to 4 minutes. Seem to have the jitters in the dark. October 2nd. More wind and rain. All men getting a throat swab test by the Jap MO for a diphtheria. A big ship in harbor with white crosses on it. Another rifle died. They have lost 6 since coming here. October 4th. The Japs took away Halbert's pet monkey. He has made an electric toaster and a water heater by cutting into the wall and hooking them up. He must keep them hidden in the wall at all times. The Japs would confiscate them on sight. October 5th. 9 Canadians died since moving here. Old Paddy Armstrong today, clear and hot. October 6th, another rifle died. Italian drawn up in Hollis Square. One fellow who put a small onion in his pocket while on a ration party was put in the center. A very solemn warning delivered by the officer commanding on such conduct. October 7th, Marcel Robidoux and Herb Mab died of diphtheria. I knew them well. More likable fellows would be hard to find anywhere. We shall miss them. October 9th. W. Moore of B Company died today. A supply of diphtheria antitoxin finally arrived in camp. 1 bun a day, but 20 ounces of rice. A rumor has swept through camp that the boat that left here was loaded with Imperial POWs, was sunk with all hands, 1,000 strong. Mass was said for them in the RFC chapel this morning. October 11th. 5 men died last night. 3 rifles. Percy Isles of B Company and an Imperial. Like the most of the men, I am getting dozens of plague ulcers on my legs. My tongue is swollen and so sore that eating is painful business. There is no salt in the rice or greens. October 12th, three rifles died, one grenadier. Second throat swab for diphtheria. October 13th, yeast issue has been cut. October 14th, Thomason died, an old grenadier, was on the old police force. It has suffered heavily. Cecil Fiennes did all he could for Thomason, gave him soy sauce, etc., but all to no avail. Did his very best for Manaway. The Japs are beating up all men they see without a mask, or anyone going near the diphtheria hospital. Used rifle butts on one man, broke three ribs. October 5th, a rifle sergeant died today. We got a spoonful of peanut oil on the rice. October 16th, another rifle died today, also Forbes of C Company, Grenadiers. Total death today were three rifles and Forbes and the East Home. October 17th, my eyes are giving me a great pain and there is no more boric eyewash left. At the MI room, the Japs blamed the deaths on the hospital orderlies, lined them up and slapped all their faces, even struck Major Crawford, RMC, across the face with a rubber hose, drawing blood. October 18th, my eyes are much worse, cannot open the right one at all. October 19th, Santa Camp Hospital. October 20th, in hospital. Looking back on my stay in Camp Hospital from this comfortable distance, I recall it was one of the grimmest experiences through which I passed. About a dozen of us eye cases were in a hut by ourselves. All windows are boarded up to keep out the light. We had bandages over our eyes. It was torture to go out in the sun to the latrine only a couple of dozen yards away. Doctors were far too busy with diphtheria and dysentery cases to come to see us. The orderlies brought us our meals, but my tongue was so swollen and the inside of my mouth was so sore that all sense of taste was gone. After a few days, I simply loathed the rice and the green horror, which resembled fireweed or clover stalks. I would choke down a mouthful of rice and hand the plate over to McLean, who sat beside me, and marvel at the way that he could eat down. Freeman was in the hut. He had been dying by inches for a month, the orderly said, because he couldn't force down the rice and greens anymore. He passed away on the fourth day that I was in there. The sinister conviction slowly came over me that I would go the same way if I stopped eating. I thought to myself, Freeman lasted a month. I can't hope to last much longer at this rate. I must eat. Next meal, two spoonfuls of rice, no use. I couldn't work up any saliva in my mouth. Then, if I only had some salt. But where and how? One hope. If I could get in touch with Carl Jonasson. If he couldn't get me any, no one could. He brought me two spoonfuls the next day, but I couldn't even taste the salt. I wondered dazedly, surely this can't be then. Will I go out the way Freeman did, skin and bones, raving with his last breath about Red Cross parcels? I lay in that dark hut for 8 days with a throbbing pain in my eyes that never lit up. But though I stopped eating after the fourth day, I had no pangs of hunger, no inclination to eat whatever. I was getting weaker but could not rest or sleep for more than a few hours at a time on account of my eyes. I thought there is one thing that could save me if I could get up to Bone Road. That night, the orderly said, no more patients going to Bone Road. It was like a death sentence. So I nearly cried for joy when Reed walked in on the 28th of October, 1942, and announced, all eye patients get ready for Bone Road. I still believe that saved my life and saved the sight of my left eye and the partial sight in the right one. When weighed, after being there for a week, I weighed 117 pounds. The eye specialist in charge of us told me that I had a bad ulcer in the right eye, but after 3 months it healed, and as he put it, it's left scar tissue that's part of your eye. Your vision in that eye will always be distorted, like looking through a bubble in a window pane. We got our first British Red Cross parcel on November 30th of 1942. It was wonderful. The first week in the parcel, Jack Hardy and I both gained a pound a day. On Christmas Day, we received 10 yen, a gift from the Canadian government. Then, at the end of January, each man received 16 yen, but canteen prices were very high, and only a very small variety of food stuff available. The draft of about 600 Canadians who took... February 28th, 43, back at Champchapeau. There are about 2,000 men in all units in this camp now. Over 700 of these are in the camp hospital, mostly with sore feet and cardiac beriberi. March 2nd. A new order came out. No one under 50 can wear a beard. March 4th. On fatigue, carrying bricks and bags and pulling a big cement roller. March 5th. Rumor has it that the Japs asked the Indian troops to volunteer for service with them and that they refused, so they starved them for a week till they finally gave in. Then 150 of them were put to guard an airfield in the new territories, and in one night they all disappeared. March 6th. Told on parade this evening that there is a ton of Canadian mail in the colony for us. It has to be censored before distribution. On Sundays, we get a bun made from brown atta Indian flour. March the 9th. Heavily overcast, drizzling, rain, on fatigue in the kitchen, scouring black, burnt, greasy old pots and pans with gravel and ashes, assisted by Walter Jenkins. His company was the only bright spot in the whole day. March the 13th, went to church, fine sermons, two sergeants in the front pew with their shoes off. March the 16th, M.F. Durant, very busy shoe repairing. We are still trying to make a stringed musical instrument, some even hoping he won't succeed. March 19th, an issue of 1 pound of sugar per man, and they poured water on that sugar before they weighed it. It was just a sticky mass, and it was... We never got our pound of sugar. It was half water. Clara Purse went into hospital with yellow jaundice. March 20th, Garnet Stodgill died early this morning of dysentery, pellagra, and malnutrition. Staff McNaughton has a lot of bets on regarding the end of the war. Japs are making the boundary of our camp smaller. A gang of Chinese women are working on the fence, digging holes. Pigs, ducks, and hens have been brought into camp by order of Tokunaga, but none ever find their way to our kitchen. March 21st of 43, Roy Kirk got two letters from Peggy Lloyd in Jamaica. A great mystery which has never been explained. March 22nd, working in the garden. I'm getting badly sunburned. Bed bug or something fierce tonight. March 24th. We're trying to irrigate the garden, have a number of lengths of pipes, several tanks, but have not sufficient flow of water for good results. March 25th. Had my PAM read tonight by Charlie Dragon of the Hong Kong Volunteers. I'm afraid I haven't much faith in his prophecy. March 28th, went to church, sermon on Naaman being cured of leprosy. A little different to the way Billy Sunday told it in his book, Hitting the Sawdust Trail. Hank Lawson is talking about Oak Lake and wishing he were there. A few letters came into camp, had been written a year ago, none for me yet. April 1st, old J.J. Davis died of heart failure. Went to a lecture tonight entitled God in Education. While it was in progress, we could hear strains of music and wild cries from a nearby hut where a square dance was being tried out. April 4th, Sunday, I went to church, then with Lieutenant Mays, who was in charge of the garden party, and planted a large number of sweet potato cuttings. April 5th, Jap sentries are trying to buy clothes from our men, shirts, underwear, and putties. So much rain, the big drain is overflowing. After it went down, we saw numbers of dread rats drowned by the rushing waters. Tonight, Buzz Winden was telling me how he first started the business at Pilot Mound, and how his wife proved such a splendid partner and helpmate. April 7th, we were paid 10 yen today. We donated 2 yen per man to the kitchen. April 8th, worked in the garden planting sweet potato vines. April 9th, Kamloops, this was what we nicknamed one of the Dutch guards who had been raised on the West Coast as a child and who hated Canadians. Kamloops, we nicknamed him Kamloops, and he hated Canadians. Kamloops discovered the Dutch radio. The Dutch Navy had a radio, seized it, and marched them all off the guard room. Also took some of our men he caught gambling. The Dutch were beaten up something cruel. Our men were forced to carry heavy loads of bricks on the double for 2 hours. April 10th, two men were beaten insensible for talking to a sentry. Coarse rock salt with snail shells in it costs 65 yen per pound and is going up. The canteen is almost sold out of everything. We're lucky if we can get a little salt, soy sauce, or bean curd. June the 1st, 43. We are sleeping on the concrete floor since the raised board platform has been taken away. A newspaper printed by the Japanese in English for our benefit has stopped coming into camp. We do not miss it, though we sometimes got a good laugh out of it. Their propaganda is so outrageous, it's ridiculous. A big inspection by the camp commandant, Tokunaga. Hot water showers are now actually working once a week. Concert last night was called off on account of rain. Our roof leaking like a sieve. Tickets were given back. June 6th, 43. Old Dave Johnson went into camp hospital, has lost a lot of weight. June 7th, old Dave Johnson died this evening. Dave Johnson was a veteran of World War I. He had a silver plate in his head from the Battle of Vimy Ridge. When he was being checked here in Winnipeg, Crawford asked the colonel to come in, and he said, that was Colonel Kay, our first colonel, and he said, "What do you think of this?" And he parted Dave Johnson's hair, and here's the silver plate. And he said, "Here's a man that got this plate put in his head from the First World War," he said, "and he's in here trying to enlist." Colonel Kay said, "Sign him on," he said. "One volunteer is worth 20 conscripts." And Johnson had just finished paying for the farm he got from the Soldier Settlement Board. He just finished, and he left a wife and 2 daughters. And he died in prison camp. I was one of the pallbearers. At 10:30, we carried the bodies to chapel services. It was Dick Wilson, Carpenter, Jimmy Guard, Pop Wharf, Olson, and I, dressed in tunics, shorts, putties. We had to bore them. We had to do a lot of boring to get them off. We'll certainly miss old Dave. On the evening of June the 26th, 1943, I received my first letter from home with a Pipestone postmark of April 22nd, 1942. And I didn't get it till June of 43. August 14th, I am one of 480 warned of draft for Japan. 380 Canadians, 25 Dutch Navy, remainder are Imperials. We have had 2 paid, one of 24 yen and one of 30 yen. We can buy practically nothing as prices are exorbitant and the supplies are very limited. I bought a pound of salt and a pint of soy sauce. We have been vaccinated and had 3 inoculations and 2 stool tests. We've been penned off from the rest of the camp with barbed wire for the last week. The bakery has baked a batch of buns to feed us in the voyage. Total strength of Grenadiers when we landed in Hong Kong, 915 officers, NCOs, and men. Casualties in war, 137. Number of men we lost while POW up until August 15th. of 43 was 53. We embarked on draft for Japan on Sunday morning, August 15, 1943. We were crammed in the hold on top of coal, so closely packed together, there was never room for everyone to lie down at the same time. There were 300 men in our hold, and for some days, only 10 men were allowed on deck to use the latrines at one time. As many had chronic diarrhea, this was a deplorable state of affairs. Red Cross supplies were put on board for us, but the Japs used them themselves, and what they couldn't use, they threw overboard. Our buns we took on board were soon covered with a thick, grayish, hairy mold. We cut the outside off and ate the rest until the mold progressed through the buns and made us sick. Then we ate rice, and we were served a fish stew so rank many of us could not eat it, and those who did were sick. But the worst of all was when heavy planks were put over the hatchways and canvas over that, and we sweltered in the terrible heat down below. We took off every article of clothing we had and fanned ourselves till we were utterly exhausted. I have a good idea now of what it must have been like in the black hole of Calcutta or in the dark holds of the African slave ships. I saw E.C. Harrison of Bury, Quebec, while he himself was sick on the voyage, give up his blankets and bed space to another sick man who, for lack of space, was clinging to a ladder. Harrison then perched on the ladder himself for days. He was one of the most self-sacrificing men I ever saw. His brother, an unarmed stretcher bearer, was killed by the Japs while tending wounded men in the battle at Hong Kong. Harrison himself died of dysentery in Camp 5B in Japan. His parents have every reason to be proud of him. I am proud of the fact that I knew him and that he counted me one of his friends. The mystery man on board was Sub-Lieutenant Bush of the British Navy. He was said to have married a Japanese girl before the war. He spoke the language like a native, still wore his naval uniform and cap, and was allowed extraordinary privileges. He was up on deck all the time. He wasn't allowed to do much for us, but I think he did what he could. When we stopped at the southern tip of Formosa, he managed to get one pomelo for each of us. We were allowed to buy it. They were, well, a poor imitation of a grape, but mostly peel and pit, but they tasted wonderful to us at the time. This Sub-Lieutenant Bush of the British Navy was a tall, handsome fellow. He looked every inch a naval officer. We often wondered if he would be allowed to join his wife in Japan or if it would turn out to be a mixed marriage tragically marred by war. We lay at anchor for 2 days at the northern tip of Formosa while we had another stool test. Very hot and hard to breathe where we are penned down below. Our drinking water is rationed. We finally docked near Osaka late afternoon of September 1st, marched a short distance, then climbed aboard streetcars, then changed to a train. The railway was laid right along the coastline for miles and miles, and we had a constant view of the open sea on our left as we sped north and of the mountains on our right. We passed through many tunnels. When mealtime arrived, each man was given a small square wooden box, about 6 inches square and 1 inch deep. It was full of rice with a little seaweed and pickle on it. We traveled roughly, we think, 180 or 200 miles north before we reached Camp 5B on the outskirts of the city of Niigata. We had to learn to count in Japanese for roll call. And many had difficulty in learning this, and a mistake in the count was always an excuse for the Jap sergeant to beat the man up. Some of us were sent to work on the Marutsu docks, others to the Rinko coal yards, a third gang to the Shintetsu foundry. Our group started work on the docks on September 6th of 43. Now we've reached October the 18th. About 300 Americans from the Philippines arrived here, all dressed in blue jeans and smocks and wearing blue composition sun helmets that the Filipino scouts once wore. October 25th. I received a letter from my brother Dave, the second letter I have received from Canada since I left it 2 years ago. October 30th, working every day in the rain and wind. Chief Laurie of the Dutch Navy died of pneumonia due to exposure in all weathers at work. October 31st, socks completely worn out, boots in bad shape. Chafe and blistering feet causing festering sores. Hands numb with cold at work today. Two hailstorms and a lot of rain on the docks. No meds. Very hungry and miserable. 16 cases of pneumonia in this camp hospital now. November 1st, 45. The work is hard and heavy, loading manganese ore from the dock with hand carts into railroad cars. November 2nd, began work at 8 and worked till 8 at night. Tired, hungry, footsore. Two men died today. November 3rd, my heels are skinned. Every step is agony. One of the boys said he thought the fellows who died in battle were the lucky ones. He envied them. November 4th, unloading charcoal out of a barge. Had the first hot bath since we reached Japan. We had to bath in large wooden troughs after the coolies had had their bath. We had to get in the same water. Coster and Jenkins, very ill at work today. November 6th, working at charcoal in the rain, soaked to the skin, very miserable. No place in camp to dry our clothes. A Yank died today. November 9th, still raining, still carrying charcoal. Infection in my hands, badly swollen. Heels raw, very miserable. Reed of the Rifles died today. Makes 11 dead since we arrived here. At least they will never be. They will never be hungry or cold anymore. November 10th, still piling straw bags full of charcoal up on a huge stack on the riverbank. November 12th, unloading platers from a ship into our warehouse, raining again, soaking wet. We all have bad colds. November 13th, working in the rain. An American died today. November 14th, Ray K. died today. Tonight, a few canteen supplies come in. 4 packets of fish powder to be drawn for by 50 men. November 15th, Canadians have had their battle dress taken away. The only warm woolen clothes they had. Our battle dress was given to the Americans, and we were issued with Japanese uniforms that were dirty and just crawling with lice. And some of them had blood on them. I think they were taken off dead soldiers. I think they were.
Who took your uniforms from you?
The Japs took our uniforms from us and gave them to the Americans. These Americans were the survivors of the death march of Bataan, and they had fought at Corregidor. And they had good blue jeans and good blue smocks, but why the Japs took away our warm battle dress and gave them to the Americans, we'll never know. It was the most incredibly stupid thing. November 16th, another rifle died during the night, named Sardi. Tonight, after work, each man has to hand in a shirt. Pretty soon, we will be naked. November 17th, 43, feeling tough. The enormous radish, which they call the daikon, does not seem to agree with my stomach. November 18th, Danilock and Evans put in hospital. Cold in our hut. You can see your breath quite plainly. November 19th, another Yank died today. We cannot even get warm in bed. November 20th, Fisher, a Dutchman, died early this morning. About 6 inches of straw has been spread on the floor for sleeping on. November 21st, Rifleman Haley died today. The Japs are issuing our battle dress to Americans. We have been given old, dirty, torn Japanese uniforms infected with lice, and we have no hot water or any means of disinfecting them. November 22nd, Knapp of the Rifles died early this morning. Corporal Breen a little later. November 23rd, Evans died today, and Stan Hunter. We have been ordered to turn in everything made of blanket material. You see, some of the men cut something off their blankets to make mitts. And the Japs said, "Where'd you get those?" And they took them back. When the Japs saw that they'd cut part of their blankets to make mitts, then these fellows were badly beaten up. We've been ordered to turn in everything in blanket material. So all the fellows who made their mitts are the blankets they had to hand in their mitts. We have just started to make, we had just started to make socks and mitts out of blankets. The Japs found out, so they ordered. November 27th, loading coke into railway cars. Every week there is an inspection to see if we have broken any dishes issued from the Japs. November 25th, cold and rainy, loading barrels onto the freight cars first, then later loading charcoal into cars. We got very wet. November 29th, Robertson died today. Loading charcoal, rainy, windy, and cold. November 30th, Nick Chirac died today. We worked on charcoal, salt, and bean curd. December 1st, a white frost, the first we ever had, over everything. About a quarter of an inch of ice in all the puddles. Worked on charcoal, rope, and stone, feeling tough with diarrhea. November 2nd, Daniluk and Corporal Ingalls died. We worked on barrels and charcoal. December 3rd, very cold at work, and I yank died. We were issued old Jap putties and one pair of thin white cotton summer socks. No heel, shapeless from top to toe. December 4th, went to work after a bad night, up seven times to go to the toilet. Another yank died. December 5th, bitterly cold. Huey McTaggart, Sudan, and an American died today. December 6th, got back from work tonight and heard Archie Rutherford had just died. Hard, very hard. He was an old grenadier. Archie had always been so optimistic. He'd done his best to cheer the boys up all the time we were in Hong Kong. He used to wear a little checkered cap on the top of his head and tell the weirdest yarns, anything to make the boys forget their troubles. No C Company man will ever forget Archie Rutherford. December 7th, windy, cloudy, and raw, loading charcoal and beer and bean curd. The Japs took back the dishes they had issued us because someone had broken a bowl. Wednesday, December 8th, another yank died. Very mean weather for work, a howling gale, sleet, rain, snow. December 9th, cold, miserable, working on manganese ore and bean curd. Smith of the Rifles died today. December 10th, snowing all day at work, wet, slushy, and miserable. December 11th, snowing heavily, wet, and slushy. December 13th, loading barrels in a barge, then cement on a boat and rice into the warehouse. A yank died today. December 14th, a hard white frost. December 15th, a thaw, very wet, loading cement and rice. December 16th, milder, loading cement, needle, and charcoal. December 17th, out of our group of 50 men, only 19 have been coming out to work. The rest have been sick in camp. The Japs forced an extra 7 out today, but they are not fit to work. They can hardly walk. Little Waterhouse of the Royal Rifles, one of the gamest kids I ever saw, too small for heavy work, sick and underweight, he toiled uncomplainingly. Sheer willpower sustained of man when a veritable walking skeleton he tottered in from work between two of us. Death came as a merciful release. December 18th, very wet, rain, loading rice. 28 men out today, but some had a hard time getting back into camp tonight. The mile and a half walk was almost too much for them. They had to be helped by a man on each side. December 19th, raining, snowing, cold, miserable. Another yank died. December 20th, on return from work, all our beds and kits were strewn around. It seems that some rations had been stolen. Big McLaughlin had just died. We did not get supper till 9:30. But men who were caught with stolen rations were thrown in the guard room, and two of them were tied outside to post all night. It was, you see, there was Red Cross supplies stored in a shed, and the Jap guard were using them up, and there was a window just about 6 foot off the ground, open window on one side of this shed where the Red Cross supplies were, and naturally it's a trap. It was a trap, that's all it was. And Tetman
an American and Mortimer of the Royal Rifles, in the middle of the night, they crept out and leaped up, grabbed the, they got in, and of course there's a Jap guard just waiting inside with a rifle. It was just a trap. And they were tied to posts all night, and in the morning when we were lining up to go to work, the interpreter, the camp command made this speech that this was to be an object lesson. Anyone trying to get at any Red Cross supplies, you see, they were tied their hands behind them, and they were on a length of about 6 foot of rope, and they would run around the post. There's snow on the ground. You see, they're barefoot, and there's snow on the ground. They'd run around the post, the rope wound right up tight, and they'd run around the opposite way, and then they were doing that just running around. And the camp commandant, took a heavy club and beat Tevlin right in front of all of us. He just smashed his skull. But Mortimer was put in the camp hospital with frozen feet, but gangrene set in, and he didn't live very long. December 25th. Clear and cold. Had to go to the foundry, 2 mile march, and carry breakfast back in big wooden buckets. It was spaghetti, not enough to go around. Crop had to go around collecting back a large spoon from each man to make up what he was short. That was December 25th, 43. Walter Jenkins said, "And a faint and forced the laughter, and a sadness follow after, we are richer by one mocking Christmas past." I think that's a line from Kipling's Christmas in India. I think we are richer by one mocking Christmas past. everything in the turmoil. I think organized confusion reigned. We heard out and had our pictures taken. Had our pictures taken. Yes. Then the long wait for dinner. After 1 o'clock, none in sight. Sky clouded over. Began to rain. A cheerless prospect. Dinner finally arrived. A very small portion of rice. A little spaghetti. Then we were issued. We were actually issued the man that had been on the work parties at the docks. Not the fellows in the hospital, but just the man who had been on the work parties were issued 4 small oranges, just culls, miserable wizened specimens, and a few sweet biscuits. The only bright spot in the day was when each man got 6 ounces of bully beef and a piece of bread for supper. December 26th. We got water to wash our clothes, our bodies. Everyone is lousy. All have bad colds and feet continually wet. The wind whistled through this bleak barn of a place. No food in this camp. We marched out to where we worked on the docks and waited for breakfast. When it came, the rice was raw, just nicely warmed up. We ate dinner and supper on the docks. Weather raw and rough. Wind, sleet, and rain. Soaking wet again. How long, O Lord? How long? December 27th. No floor in the new hut, just loose sand. The second tier of bunks is 10 feet above the first, reached by a frail and shaky ladder, a high roof, open at the peak, cold and drafty.
December 28th. Bitterly cold today, a piercing wind. Stumbling back later through mud and slush in the dark. Pardon me. Wallace has died. Also one of the rifles. A very nice kid. Should never have been in the Army at all. Harding, another rifle, died at lights out. December 29th, raining again. Loading pig iron, charcoal. Bolting our meal, no time to eat properly. A dismal day. Loading pig iron. Saturday, January the 1st, 1944. About 3:30, early this morning, when we were all sound asleep from fatigue in a long bunk shed on the sandy hillside, I was awakened by the wrenching, creaking sound of straining timbers. All was in darkness. The hut seemed to be sinking beneath me. Then I heard the awful screams of men crushed and trapped beneath the wreckage. The very first thing I thought was earthquake, as I felt the building settling over me. I was on the upper bunk, but not all the deaths were in the lower. On my right, beneath the beams, died Staff Sergeant Sword and Les Sampson, and on my left, Harold Jones was killed. And just the day before, Harold Jones had said to me, I'm going to be lucky. He said, I've got 2 7s in my regimental number. And he said, that's very lucky. And I said, I certainly hope you make it. And he said, I suppose you'd laugh at me if I told you that last night I was praying for my mother, my sister. And I said, I'd never laugh at any man for praying. I said, I pray every night, and I said, I know my people are praying for me. In the lower bunk, little Joe Fury, one of the brightest boys that ever enlisted. He was from Sydney. Little Joe Fury. Jim Fury's brother, yes. Little Joe, we used to call him Little Joe the Wrangler. We used to nickname that. One of the brightest boys that ever enlisted, one of the most cheerful, most helpful, the kindest hearted friends a man ever had, lay lifeless beneath the heavy timber. The rescue crew cut holes in the roof to get us out, and without knowing it, their additional weight on the roof was crushing us more. It was a night of horror. The cries of suffering men unable to move with the weight of the wreckage above them. When the first boards were ripped up above me, I felt the wind and the drifting snow on my face. 7 men died that night and 8 later, and 17 were put in hospital with cracked or broken ribs or pelvises. Jerry Mabley was one with a broken hip and put in a huge cast. And all the men with broken hips were put in casts. And when the lice got inside the casts, they endured the tortures of the damned. Next day, I was one of the 3 men detailed to put the dead men in their coffins. It was a cold day, snowing and blowing. We were shivering, and these men lay stark naked in a row, as cold as ice. The coffins, cheap, flimsy affairs, roughly and crudely made, were too short for the bodies. We had to knock out the ends of the coffin so the bodies would lie down. January 9th, we were issued with straw shoes. The snow just melted enough to give us very wet feet. Watson and Boulding died. January 10th, a Yank caught stealing rations was beaten up and tied to a post all night. All other huts in camp are being propped up with rows of poles along each side in the hope that no more buildings will fall down. It's a wonder they stand up at all. There's hardly a nail in them. That's true, hardly a nail in them. January the 13th, loading pig iron into 30-ton gondolas, and even into refrigerator cars that still have large blocks of ice in them. The slabs of pig iron weigh anywhere from 50 pounds up to 200 pounds, and it took 2 to 3 men to lift a 200-pound slab because we were in very poor shape. These slabs of pig iron have very jagged edges, very hard in the hands. We are issued with a pair of straw mitts every month. They wear out in a single day. January the 14th, unloading bundles of iron rods. Caruso died today, Grenadier. He used to sing a lot. I don't suppose he was related to the great singer, but his name was spelled the same way. Caruso died today, and two Americans. January 17th, cold and frosty, worked hard, long, late. No time to eat our suppers out there. Had to carry it in the camp in our own dishes. Tonight, American Red Cross boxes were finally released. Each box divided between two men. I got 1 12-ounce tin of corned beef, 4 ounces of coffee, 7 ounces of butter, 8 ounces of powdered milk, 1 bar of chocolate, 4 packages of cigarettes, which I traded off for soap. You could always trade cigarettes for soap. The Wrinkle Gang never washed because they were working in coal dust all the time, and we could always get their soap for cigarettes. 4 ounces of powder of canned salmon, 3 ounces of mill pate, 2 ounces of jam. This is the first really pleasant thing that has happened to us since we landed in Japan. It all tastes wonderful. I don't know which article of diet is the best. January 18th, we moved back to our old camp. Well, all right. March 21st. I'm in bed with a badly swollen right leg. March the 22nd. Infection is set in. Our work party is down to 11 men. Old Ed Arsenal went out to work today for the first time since the hut crash in the other camp. I got a large hypodermic injection in my bad leg. It was just absolutely the color of, you know, when you buy a brand new stovepipe that's kind of a purplish black. It was, I couldn't bend the knee joint. I just couldn't bend it. It was swollen and it was so stiff. But March 23rd, another needle in the leg. A big inspection today. I am bedded down, told to keep off my right leg. It looks like blood poisoning. This evening, American Red Cross parcel to Richard, one between every two men. We are very thankful. March 24th, I was actually ordered into hospital today. The room for cripples and beriberi cases. About 15 of us in this little room, a tiny heater in the center. Old Lou Young from Meadow Lake is in here, and Walter Jenkins. My leg is dark blue from ankle to knee and has a queer appearance. Shiny, like polished metal. Lance today seems full of bloody pus. I am very drowsy. Can hardly keep my eyes open during the day. The Japanese have taken most of the powdered milk out of our parcels. March 25th, 2 cases came over from Shintetsu, both with broken limbs. I got a needle in the arm and had my leg opened up again, and I have it propped high above my body. March 26th, another needle in the arm. Bathed leg with hot water. March the 27th, the Japs are carousing in their quarters. We can hear their songs and drunken laughter. One of the coal gang was carried in here, the Wrinkle. Coal gang was carried in here with a broken leg. He fell off the trestle. March the 28th, 44. The usual wrangle going on between the patients and the orderlies. The beriberi cases are mad for water, and they mustn't have it. They mustn't have it. And those on restricted diet want more food and can't have it. And there is a living skeleton here who has to be forced to eat by threats of cutting him off tobacco and water. Tonight, we were issued with some Red Cross clothing. We should have had it months ago. all of good U.S. manufacture. One wool blanket, shirt, and a pair of socks, and a heavy winter cap, and a pair of leather gloves. Unfortunately, my gloves are both for the right hand. Can you imagine that? March the 29th, a dull rainy day. Japs have taken out our stove. But the hospital patients have actually been issued pajamas. 14 American medical staff came in tonight dressed in naval uniforms. March the 31st, 44, a beriberi patient who is on a limited liquid diet got up in the middle of the night and stole some water. This morning he is all puffed up again. We were moved back to the other camp, the scene of the hut crash. April 1st, 44. Hospital patients rode in the back of the truck on the top of the luggage, very rough and cold, very drafty in the new camp. April 2nd, no more isolation. Dysentery patients are mixing up with the beriberis, etc. April 3rd, lugal, a sort of barley porridge today. A fish head for breakfast. I ate it all, even the eyes. I am very hungry. April 5th, 44. Boys do not care for the lugal, too much water in it, prefer dry rice or millet. Robinson, an American sailor, 18 years in the Navy, died today. April 10th, parole, a rifle, died today. April 16th, an American named Haglund from Oakland, California, came in the hospital today in the bed space beside me. He is a skeleton if ever I saw one. Tonight we're issued cards and told we might write a few words home. Haglund asked me if I would write his card for him. I said, certainly. What should I write? He gave me his mother's address and told me to say that he was fine and that they mustn't worry and to send his love. I hesitated, but he begged me to, so I wrote it and hoped his mother would forgive me when she eventually heard the truth. April 17th, Haglund very weak this morning. I raised his head and gave him a mouthful of hot coffee. And when he lay back, he swallowed once and was gone. I never saw anyone slip away so easily. Now the doctor and two orderlies are arguing whether they should allow his card to be mailed home or not. April 19th, 44. They're working on building a huge lumber trough in camp to bath in. April 21st, 44. Rob Lee of the Rifles died today at 10 o'clock. He had beriberi, infected leg, and amoebic dysentery. Total of 92 POWs out of 600 who have died since we landed in Japan. Out of 300 who are Canadians, 75 have died. April 26th, my birthday again, I was discharged from hospital. After a week and quarters, I went out to work again, worked for 10 days, and my leg was as bad as ever again. Back and quarters, hoping a rest will affect cure. The last issue of Red Cross parcels came in a week ago. Each parcel had to be divided among five men. All men in quarters, except those excused all duties, are working hard, pumping and carrying water all day to fill the big wooden tank, which is going to serve as a bathtub. The huts we slept and ate in were long, barn-like structures about 200 feet long and 40 feet wide. Down the center was just the ground, in this case, light loose sand, which was full of sand fleas. There was a sort of a raised platform which ran down each side of the building, about a foot off the ground, which we slept and ate while eating. First, a thin straw mat was laid in the platform, then our blankets. We had one good wool American Red Cross blanket and four thin cotton frayed Japanese blankets, which were much too short for us. You pulled them up to your chin, your feet stuck out a foot. When winter came, we were forced to turn in one blanket, which was utter madness. We couldn't keep the fleas out of our blankets. When you woke in the morning and sat up, the fleas would be dancing around you like hundreds of young grasshoppers springing up around your feet as you walk through the new grass in the spring. They raised a big welt wherever they bit, so you looked as though you had a bad case of the hives. They were very hard to catch and hard to hold while you killed them. As soon as the man came in from work, they would take off their boots and put on a sort of wooden sandal with a strap across the top known by various names as skivvies or go-aheads, as you couldn't walk backwards. The straps were always tearing off the sole, and so many men were prone to borrow a neighbor's when one of his became unserviceable, so this was a constant source of friction. I saw one real bare-fist fight over that. Who's got my skivvies? I have, someone answered. Well, take the blankety-blankety-blank things off. And what if I don't? Why, I'll punch you in the nose. And putting his words to action, he promptly proceeded to do so. They really mixed it, and blood soon began to flow because they were big men. But actually, after a few minutes, they were simply winded and gasping for breath because they were in no shape to fight. They weren't in shape to work, really. They were in no shape to fight. And their friends got in between them. But if you are hungry and worried and overworked and apprehensive, tempers, fray, and small incidents which you would laugh off in normal life lead to bitter words and quarrels. By the time the first winter in Japan arrived, in 43, the soles of my boots were worn through. There's always loose bits of straw rope lying around the docks where I worked, and I used to tie these around my boots to keep my bare feet off the ground. Needless to say, the rope had to be renewed several times a day and was a great nuisance at best. The Jap civilians who watched us as we marched to work used to point and laugh at our feet. The ordinary footwear for the majority of the Jap workers is what they called katabas. Katabas, some called them ekutsis. It's a rubber-soled shoe with a cloth top that hooks up the back. The big toe is divided from the other four-toe. The foreman of the gang tried to make us wear some old worn-out pairs that are too small for us, and the divided portion blistered the inside of our toes. The Japanese wore a lot of wooden sandals themselves. But some of the Japs soldiers they were called Haytai, H-A-Y-T-I, the Jap soldiers. They wore a cheap leather shoe. But most of them, for combat, wore the divided rubber shoe. Besides, it always reminded me of the cloven hoof, and I thought of the trail of the serpent and the mark of the beast. The first winter in Japan, as I say, we were issued straw boots, which were always too small for us, and it wouldn't have been too bad if it had been dry and frosty all the time, but there was constant thaw, and it was impossible to keep our feet dry. It's impossible. It's hard to remember all the different things we handled in the docks. For days we carried charcoal of the river barges and stacked in huge piles near our shack. Some was put in straw bags, some in wicker framework, and we handled coke with the yo-yo shoulder poles. We handled huge crocks of acid spray, long iron rods, army goods, clothing, crude rubber looted from Malay, compressed with steel bands into huge square blocks, very heavy, creosote ties. All sorts of commercial fertilizer, lumber, poles, a lot of dried fish and huge straw bales, and some sort of raw shark with an odious smell, a white chemical they called ion, and huge bales of something like raffia, might have been gun cotton, drums of fuel oil, and cases of canned goods. Dysentery was rife in camp, and the camp commander had some queer ideas as to its cause. He told us we caught cold in our stomachs, and we must guard against this by what seemed to us absurd precautions. When we stewed too for roll call, Jap called it tenko, for roll call, every morning and night, we had to have a blanket tightly wrapped around our middle. It must be able to stay in place without holding. Did you know that it's a deadly insult to call a Mexican a Mexican? They prefer to be called Spanish and still speak what they call Spanish, although I suspect it's far from the pure Castilian that the conquistadors used. Anyway, one of the Spaniards was late for evening roll call, and grabbing his blanket, he slung it loosely about him and held it to his side with his arms. Unfortunately, he was in the front rank. He was filling in by fours. An orderly sergeant spotted him and ordered him to raise his arms. The man raised his right one. Raise the other, was the crisp command. The man dropped his right and raised his left. Raise them both, thundered the RGF. The trembling Spaniard raised his arms, and the blanket dropped on his feet. And
the Jap just smashed that poor devil in the face with his fists time after time. It was so utterly, needlessly cruel. It was bestial. It was bestial. Military discipline among the Jap armed forces is invariably some form of corporal punishment administered in the squad. While in Hong Kong, in North Point Camp, I remember an officer making the rounds and a guard being lax on duty. The officer called him stiffly to attention, shouting, "Jotske." Then, using the flat of each hand alternately on the sides of the man's face and a regular sideways roundhouse delivery, till even the officer was panting with his exertion, and the private's face was red and swollen. In our camp at Niigata, when the camp commandant became enraged, just for instance, if his bath was cold, he called the orderly sergeant, administered a thorough drubbing. He, in turn, beat up the corporal, who retaliated on the private, and the private had no one to vent his spleen on but the prisoners. So he hastened to the huts, and if he couldn't find an excuse easily, why, he didn't bother looking for one. We had no chairs, but were expected to sit upright in a very stiff, unnatural manner on our sleeping platform for eating. The guard, privates, used their rifle butts if they saw us reclining at mealtime. They delighted in calling us to salute them many times. First, they'd call you to attention, Kyotsuke, and then the command for salute was K-Ray. And they might have you standing to attention and saluting them maybe 25 or 30 times, just out of pure devilry, that was all. When first held as prisoners in Shamshapo, rice was cooked in old gas drums, which had the tops knocked out. They were propped up in stones and wood fire built under them. There was not even salt to savor the watery paste that resulted from several hours of boiling. Many men had lost their mess tins, and all sorts of containers were used. When the long line formed, we were fed twice a day, bought a large cupful each time. There was a strange variety of dishes present for each ration. Some men took the lining out of their steel helmets and used the outer shell for a huge bowl. Others used the reflectors around electric lights. There were lines of white enamel, and of course a wooden plug had to be inserted where the bulb originally had been. Some picked up a flat piece of tin and bent up the sides to form a shallow pan. Others made small boxes of the boards to hold the ration. In order to prevent scurvy, we were fed what we called the green horror, some kind of coarse weed stems. Some looked like bits of hollow reed. We called them whistle roots. Sometimes we had the green tops of the sweet potato plant. They ran like a creeping vine over the ground, and the last 6 inches of each vine was used. All tended to have a bitter taste, resembling but appetizing, just practically a coarse fodder. The rice in Hong Kong was of very poor quality, sweeping at the go-downs, the warehouses. And in the rice, inevitably, you'd find balls of rice about the size of a walnut, and in the center, there would always be a large maggot. And the rice around that maggot seemed to have some sticky, gummy substance that held this ball together. And then we actually had some octopus. It had a very disagreeable odor, and the sight of the suction discs gave you a very queer feeling. Some of the fellows couldn't keep it down after they ate it. North Point Camp on the island of Hong Kong, on the very edge of the North Shore, included one of the pillboxes which Jap artillery fire had splattered. We heard these were built by a German construction company some years ago because they'd put in the lowest tender of all. The outer inch was concrete. The inside was similar to poor mortar or plaster. You could pull out chunks with your hand. When the Japs strung... Oh, yes, I've told you this about the Japs camp commandant losing his pet dog on the electrified wire. One of the first things the Japs did, which seemed so childish to us, was to use some black substance, probably axle grease, to smear over all the English signs or anything in English printing in Hong Kong. In anything in English printing. Reminds me this reminds me of a curious thing. In Niigata, in Japan,
The only signs I saw in English were no smoking. Or on the warehouses, or inside the warehouse.
Well, sure.
In Japan, the first winter, the man died mostly through overwork, exposure, starvation, dysentery, beriberi, plaga, etc. And it was we never cared to dwell on the subject of death too much, for we never knew who would be next, our best friend or ourselves. When our doctor remonstrated the camp commandant, he laughed currently and said, "There were Toksan Chisai Haku, plenty of little wooden boxes to hold the cremated ashes of those who died." White rice was scarce and expensive in Japan. We were fed mainly on a mixture, which at times was mostly corneon, a sort of bluish-red millet seed, and sometimes rolled barley, often only half-cooked, as fuel was scarce and hard to get. Many of us found it hard to digest, and many found it blowed their stomachs. John the Baptist ate locusts, but he had wild honey to help them down. The grasshoppers we had in our diet in Japan looked exactly like the ones we had in Manitoba in 34, and may have been that old, too. They had never been cooked, just soaked in soy sauce, a dark, bitter liquid with a salty taste, which both Chinese and Japs use. I always tore the hind legs off my hoppers. They were like little wiry sticks and got between your teeth, while the barbs would tear the inside of your mouth. I always ate my grasshoppers head first, remembering how they had devastated my field of alfalfa in 34. The snails, which were issued as part of our rations, were part eaten but never enjoyed. They came in alive in an open tub, and at night, the night cook, George Dunn, said that they kept crawling up and falling over the edge on the floor. They were boiled a few minutes and served on, or rather in the shell. You had to use a pin or a piece of wire to pull them out. You can figure that we were desperately hungry when we tried to eat them. There was a great scarcity of metal kitchen equipment, except for the large cast iron soys, a huge bowl set in square bricks, for boiling rice. All the kegs and pails were wooden and very unsanitary. They absorbed flavors and odors, especially fish. The Rinko gang that worked in the coal yard used to bring in lumps of coal into camp in their pockets to close the day's work and made the kitchen fires to help cook our meals. Often fuel was so scarce there was no hot water for tea, but soon the guards began to search the Rinko gang when they came in. They turned the box inside out just inside the camp gate, and they were told that if they brought in any more coal that they would be severely beaten. When we first reached Niigata 5B, all our good battle dress taken from us, and I've mentioned this before, I believe, but also what was taken from us, they took our knives, our razors, any few valuables we had, and any little money we had, they took from us. The latter, they said, they would send to Tokyo to safekeeping. Just before we left Hong Kong for Japan, we were given 45 Chinese dollars. I believe this was sent in by the Red Cross. When the war was over and before we left 5B, they paid us back our money in Japanese yen. To give an idea of what this was worth, we decided to all chip in and buy a good beef animal, slaughter it, and have meat for the camp. The old farmer who led the miserable, shambling creature in the camp the next morning took off his old straw hat and wiped his sweating brow. He seemed greatly relieved he'd gotten the animal inside the gate before it collapsed. When dressed, weighing the bone as well, we had actually 200-odd pounds of meat for over 700 men. This cost us 5,000 yen. We were divided into groups. Each one had a leader. Our group lost three leaders, Captain Laurie, CPO off the Dutch submarine, HMS Ott 20,
of the Royal Dutch Navy, sunk off Kota Barrow Coast, Malaya Peninsula, 150 miles north of Singapore. Laurie was our first leader. He died of pneumonia from being soaked to skin while we were working in the rain day after day. The next leader, Staff Sword, died in the hot crash. Third leader, Mac Hawes, a handsome young giant, beloved of all his men, died just 1 month before the war ended. Out of our group of 50 men, a few were employed in camp, and most were sent out to work on the docks. Sickness took such a toll, at one time during the first winter, our work party was down to 10 men. They were still going out steadily while the rest were sick in camp. Every man who could walk out to work kept going as long as he could, for the dock company provided us with a little extra nourishment in the form of a soup, often a mixture of anything edible which was handy. But the last summer, consisting mainly of soybeans, which I firmly believe helped us more than anything else except the few Red Cross parcels which came in. If a man stayed sick in camp, his rations were cut as a punishment for not being out at work. In addition, they were forced to do the dirty camp things, such as cleaning out the latrines in midwinter and carrying the contents out in wooden buckets, emptying them outside the camp. Out on the docks, one of our main jobs was loading pig iron. It came in big ships, possibly from Antung, Manchuria, where the soybeans came from. As soon as the ships docked, they began unloading. The net which brought the large, rough slabs of pig iron out of the holder made of steel cable, which had thick-length rope woven throughout. These ropes soon frayed and tore to pieces, and there was always a gang of coolie women threading fresh rope through the spare net. The winches and the donkey engines were always run and handled by women. When a ship was unloading iron, you could hear the dull clash and clank a half a mile away. And when we heard the sound and saw the tall mast of a big ship towering up over the far side of Okita Sand's warehouse or Oba Sand's warehouse, we shivered apprehensively. We could stand it, we said, in the summer. But in winter, when we had to dig the iron out of the snow with bare hands, it was misery, pure and unadulterated. The iron had come right out of the mold, the slabs averaging 2 feet long by 10 inches wide and weighed up to as high as 200 pounds. Sometimes the odd mold itself was there, and it weighed much more. The edges of the slabs were rough and jagged like crystals of ice forming along the edge of a horse trough in the late fall. We loaded into every type of car they had, except their passenger cars. We loaded onto flat cars, into refrigerator cars, and into ordinary freight cars, into 10-tonners, 12- and 18-tonners, into open gondolas whose sides let down the whole length, and 22-tonners up to 30-tonners, where we piled the slab 6 pieces high along the edge and filled in level behind, into stock cars with slab sides, and second floors or shelves in them for sheep or pigs. We had to crawl under the second floor on our hands and knees to fill up the floor out to each end of the car. While we loaded in the door, two were needed in the car to throw back to each end. The Bosches or ox carts were entirely of wood except for a steel axle and a rubber truck tire. The animals which pulled them were not oxen, but poor old thin cows. They looked like jerseys. They had a ring in their nose and were led and pulled around by Japanese coolie women. They loaded up on the docks and pulled around the row of warehouses and dumped the loads alongside the railroad track. If the cars were weighing and ready, when we got there, they would pull alongside the coal car, and two of us would get up in the cart and throw directly into the car. After a few months, the Japs put a quota on our work. Each man was to load 15 tons of pig iron per day. This was held over us like a club. If we hadn't completed our quota, it was an excuse to cut down our rations or work longer hours. We handled many different commodities in the docks. When the big ships unloaded soybeans in the docks, there was a pile of bags as high as an ordinary house and 30 times long. Beans were an oddly large-sized bran sacks, which weighed 180 pounds. It took 3 men to lift and load one of those on the back, high up right across the neck, of the man who was going to carry it, through the warehouse and up a plank and into a freight car. Put it mildly, it is hard work, particularly the last few yards up a steep plank. When the huge pile on the docks got a heavy rain, the bags weighed a lot more, and they were swollen up, and some bags would burst. The bags were all made of rice straw, woven rice straw. The straw would be an inch thick.
the thickness of the bag. These bags were handled with a what they called a hook, a wooden handle with a steel barb in the end. And actually, a very common article of diet over there was bean curd, a mixture of ground beans and rice and salt fermented, very sour of the taste. It's packed in 50-pound wooden kegs. The tops were seldom tight, and often there'd be several inches of oily juice which floated off and would run down your back as you carried the keg through the warehouse and up in, into the freight car. The first winter, 43, in Niagara, we only had 6 inches of snow. The second winter, we had 4 feet on the level. We spent weeks shoveling out the railroad tracks. When we had piled the snow up over our heads and it still fell, we tied ropes on straw mats, piled the snow on, and dragged it to the dock and emptied the snow into the harbor. Or, after we had loaded the car with pig iron, we would shovel snow on the top of the pig iron. All would hold and ship it out just to get rid of it. I often wondered who the poor devils were who had to unload that iron. I hope they weren't POWs. There was no yard engines to spot cars, and we often pushed cars up one track, switched across and down another for an hour before we could begin work. When the snow was deep the second winter, and we had a large gang out, we had at times a long, heavy rope attached to the car with a dozen men pulling the rope and 10 pushing in the car behind. When the car was heavily loaded and could not be moved, we would bring up an empty as hard and fast as we could, hoping the impact would jar it loose. This was called by the Japs a dingarossi. When a gang of us were on the hawser of a barge towing it along the waterfront, I'll always remember Bobby McLeod striking up the chant of the Volga boat, of the Volga boatman. He always did his best to keep our spirits up. I will always regret he did not live to return with us. That's Bobby McLeod. He's from Winnipeg. He died just 1 month before the war ended. Any Japs who talked to us always had the same set of questions invariably. They would ask, how old are you? Then, are you married? And then, how many children did you have? If you weren't married, why weren't you married? And when I couldn't understand myself, how could I explain it to a Japanese? Witchcraft is not dead. Black magic still flourishes in Japan. When men were swollen up with beriberi, the Jap quack doctor laid oily paper on their stomachs and legs and set them on fire with glowing charcoal. These burns only resulted in festering sores and a great deal of additional suffering. When we first went to work in the docks, the Japanese women were frankly afraid of us. We may have been the first white man they had ever seen. The first day they ran hit. After that, they stared at us from a great distance, and finally they decided to ignore us and pretend we never existed. The last summer, they were beginning to be interested and would have been friendly if we had given them any encouragement. The only human beings in Japan who showed us any kindness were some of the old ladies who worked in the docks. They were 50 or 60 years old. If none of our foremen were watching, they might slip us a sweet potato or a pocket or a handful of what they called haramomis, which were nothing but parched soybeans. They'd take a shovel full of beans and hold them over a fire, rolling them and stirring them until they were brown and the skins cracked open. They tasted something like peanuts, but they were very hard to chew and hard to digest. But all the Japs had a handful in their pocket, tossing in their mouth one at a time. One morning, walking down the track, we came across the body of a large black cat lying on the rail. It had been cut in two by the train. We immediately exclaimed, there's something for the company soup. Joe Falcon skinned it, and Tommy Wilson cooked it in the company soup. If you didn't know what it was, you might have thought it was rabbit. After we'd finished eating it, Walt Jenkins said, you know, I've been thinking, a cat's supposed to be the most agile animal there is. And if any cat that couldn't get off the track, and any cat that couldn't get off the track must have had something wrong with it. I wonder if it was disease. But of course, it was a little late to do something anything about it after we'd eaten it. Actually, it was easily explained. We had shoveled the snow and thrown it up in the high bank, 8 feet in height on each side of the track. So it could easily have rolled down in front of the train. A week after, our foreman, came along dragging the body of a police dog, which he said had been killing his chickens. And Joe Falcon skinned it and cut it up, and then the foreman grabbed the two hindquarters and walked off with them. And we just had, and the foreman took the choicest part, and we had what was left to put in the company soup. Many of the train crews were just youngsters in their teens, and when they were shunning, they hit for all they were worth. Three cars, all coupled together, were derailed one day by the crossing next to Marishang's. We saw a big 30-ton gondola loaded with loose soybeans, which had its coupling, which normally projected 2 feet from the bed of the car, driven completely under, and the loose beans were pouring out all around the brake on the ground. But the funniest thing was an open gondola full of 4 gallon tins of Aubra, or lubricating oil, which had been hit so hard, the tins all lapped over one another. The oil was running through the floor of the car in a dozen places, and a Jap with a pail was running from one brake to another, trying to catch the oil. Speaking of leaks, the first winter, car after carload came in of leeks, spelled L-E-E-K-S, first cousin of the onion. The bulb is just the same size as the green stalk, the whole thing 2 or 3 feet long and a very mild flavor. There's no room for the warehouse, and then we stacked them outside in huge piles where they froze, and then they heated, and then they turned black and rotted, and the steam rose for weeks in a cloud in the frosty air. We handled a lot of manga or manganese ore. It resembled a sort of heavy sticky clay dumped in the dock. We had to shovel it onto wooden boxes or hand carts, pull them around the warehouse, the track, dump them in the ground, shovel them in the cars. Hard and heavy work. We handled the dogo in the same way. It was sort of a gray rock. We also carried thousands of bags of sulfur in straw bags. It was in rock form about the size of your fist. When the sulfur spilled to the floor of the warehouse from the broken bags, it crunched under your feet like frosty snow. We handled many bags of rice, storing it in warehouses 1 week, then loading it into cars the next. Handled huge cases of crate machinery, some the full length of a gondola, and huge spools of undersea cable. Actually, ever since the four Canadians escaped, we had been forced to take turns, and there was no proof that the four had ever reached safety, and we have no hope that they ever did. But the hut guard always had to be on the alert. Dare not smoke or sit down, must keep all men covered up, which was a job in itself, as some continuously kicked the blankets off. Must know the list, the number of men in his hut, and recite his list of duties. When Major Boone, the arch traitor, was orderly officer in Sham Shapo and made his rounds at night with the Kamloops kid, the Jap who was born in B.C., the two delighted in interrogating Canadians. The Kamloops kid said he had been ridiculed as a child in B.C., and he swore the Canadians would pay for it. He was particularly vindictive. The first winter, 43, in Japan, there was no bathing facilities, whatever. We were allowed to take a bath once every 2 weeks out at work after the coolies had had theirs. We were forced to undress outside the hut, snow on the ground, leave our clothes out there, walk naked in, and climb into a square wooden trough like a huge stock tank. The water was commonly 110 degrees. Soap was very scarce and hard to get. Camp 5B was set high on the edge of a range of sand hills, which was covered with a scrubby growth of evergreens. Four wells were in camp, but very seldom more than two functioned at a time. The water of two wells, the kitchen and electric well, was good. The other two were badly polluted by the latrines. The soil was pure blow sand. The farmers had little plots, which were, and they depended on human waste for fertilizer to grow their garden stuff. This was a common practice in Japan. Their commonest and most popular vegetable was the daikon, which was simply an enormous white radish, 2 feet long and 4 inches through on the average. These are about 95% water and had a hot, burning taste. It was sliced and boiled for soup or stew. Eggplant once in a while, and the odd time cucumbers. And sweet.
Born near Pipestone, Manitoba, on April the 26th, 1910. Lived and worked on a farm till I enlisted with the Winnipeg Grenadiers at Minto Armories on September the 30th, 1939. Drilled for weeks in civilian clothes till we were issued with last war uniforms with 1916 stamped just inside the tunics. Moved into Fort Osborne Barracks just before Christmas. Left Winnipeg on May the 21st, 1940. Several days before, we were issued a billfold by the Grenadiers Ladies Auxiliary. I still have mine. Reached Jamaica May the 31st, 1940, where we relieved the King's Shropshire Light Infantry, who went further south to Curacao, part of the Dutch West Indies, where they guarded huge oil refineries. Our job was simply garrison, combined with guarding a camp which contained, by the time we left, over 1,000 Germans and Italians, and some notorious local characters, including Bustamante, who has lately caused such an uproar in the island's labor situation. We left Jamaica on September the 13th, 1941, and reached Canada on September the 21st. Had 14 days furlough, and left Winnipeg on the 27th. Reached Vancouver on the... Left the harbor on the same night in Albatia. We sailed on the 28th, actually. Saturday, November the 8th, 1941, aboard the Albatia, somewhere on the Pacific. Left Vancouver, October 28th. We now know we are bound for Hong Kong. Our fresh water is rationed. Tonight, the usual poker and bingo games going on. It's very warm. Our ward, C9, serves as a dining room and a bedroom, hammocks slung in rows above our tables. November 9th, lecture by our MO, Major Crawford, on the hazards we will encounter in the way of the diseases, plagues, and germs in general. According to the bulletin, tension between the U.S. and Japan is at its height. November 10th, drill in the Bren and lecture on signals, PT every day. Some big money has changed hands in crap games. Nazis have been stopped in front of Moscow. We are way off the sea lanes, have not seen a ship for days. Robinson commended for observing a rocket flare from a friendly sub during the night. If the Army doesn't teach a man anything else, it ought to teach him to appreciate civilian life once more. November 11th, fatigues. Observe 2 minutes of silence. November the 12th, Tugby, CSM of headquarters company, is very regimental. Had C9 turned upside down, all men washing, scrubbing, and polishing, while in a lather of sweat in the close, moist heat. November 13th, we sighted land early this afternoon. Dim and hazy on the horizon, like a heavy cloud bank at first, but gradually growing more distinct. It was the Philippines. On both sides of our ship, we could distinguish tremendous breakers crashing white against the foot of the craggy coastline. A lecture on the importance of discretion on our part while in port at Manila. Tonight, there is no blackout on the ship. We can see faint lights on the shoreline. One of the crew died early this morning, was buried at sea. November 14th, we are right among the islands. They are something similar to the West Indies in appearance. Now there are sampans, a whole fishing fleet of them with their odd rectangular sails of matting, airplanes overhead, and considerable naval traffic. Harbor patrol boats. We pulled inside a long rock and concrete seawall that is built around the outside of Manila Harbor. Inside was a large part of the U.S. fleet. Destroyers and battleships, subs, and three very fast torpedo boats that shot past in a smother of foam. After taking aboard pilots and customs officers, we docked about 9. Headquarters company training period went on per usual as we lay in harbor. While some speedy U.S. fighter planes played and dived over the ships and the port, we took on oil and water before pulling out. This evening, we seem to be sailing straight into the sun. The islands are very mountainous. Always their peaks are shrouded in the clouds, a contrast to the open sea where clouds are rare. November 15th, we are in the China Sea, veering northwest, a rolling swell. We have two escorts this morning, one on each side and ahead. We drew our rifles and tin hats today. Last night, we saw a great display of searchlights from islands we were leaving. They were making the V sign for victory in the sky. Tonight, we are out of sight of the land, and the sea is rough, and some heavy showers have fallen. November 16th, Sunday. Most of us were up at 4 this morning, as there were the usual fatigues. We sighted China's shores as the dawn broke, and we passed down in the mouth of the Pearl River and then reached the dock about 7. The harbor was full of small craft. When we came down the gangplank, the first sign I noticed was a warning of a ceasefire on account of cholera. The dock police were turbaned East Indians. We formed up in a square close by the music of a pipe band of the Royal Scots, the garrison here. We marched through the city of Culver into the Hang Cow Barracks, about 3 miles. There, we saw our first rickshaw pulled by a private tourist. Our huts are built of concrete. We have the same style of iron bed we had in Jamaica with 1910 stamped on it. The mattress is in three separate pieces known as biscuits, two blankets, and sheets. One Canadian dollar is worth $3.24 in Hong Kong money at the NAPI, the British Army Canteen, but $3.60 through the proper channels. November 17th. A great relief to sleep on a bed, even if it has no springs, after weeks in a hammock. I sent a wire home. It cost $2. We have the same type of mosquito bars over our heads as we over our beds as we had in Jamaica. This is the cool season. One side of our garrison fronts on the bay and mud flats where we see natives digging for clams or some seafood. There are four main concrete drains crossing our area. Where they begin, they are only several inches deep, but where they empty into the bay, they have gradually deepened until they are 8 feet deep. In the heavy rains that followed, we were to see these drains full and overflowing from one end to the other, and even a certain individual swimming in one on a wager. November 18th. Tonight, Geeky and I went out on a midnight pass. The streets and sidewalks resound the clatter of wooden sandals. The main streets of Kowloon are quite wide. No streetcars, a lot of buses, some bicycles and rickshaws. Saw a show at the Alhambra. November 19th. We heard our copies of Hong Kong newspapers that we had tied up and stamped and addressed will not be sent home today or any day. Why? We must pay 20 cents for boat mail letters home or $2.50 for airmail. A Chinese shoemaker is taking orders for handmade shoes. He traces the outline of their feet on paper. Chinese women with glossy black hair, tightly combed and strained back from their brows, and coiled in a snug little knob at the back of the head, secured with a large brass pin, wearing dark drab garments, a sort of smock and trousers that reach between the knee and ankle, are squatting at the doors of her hut, sewing patiently away, shortening her slacks, shorts, etc. Few can understand any English. We have been warned against using fans in our huts for fear of wasting electricity. We hear the Japs are only 23 miles away on the other side of the hills. The byword here and all through our outfit, the stock reply to all hopeful or longing wishes or ambiguous statements is, that will be the day. Inevitably, it is overworked and has grown stale through frequent usage. Tugby is certainly a regimental CSM, and few appreciate him. Today, almost all the officers and NCOs went to the island of Hong Kong to inspect defenses. Old Joe Hopper was acting CSM for the day. Jimmy Young, our orderly officer, and Ballingall appointed himself the adjutant. We took all our beds apart and painted them with coal oil to discourage the bed bugs, which never tasted Canadians in this colony before and seemed to find them most satisfying. We had a swimming parade to the YMCA, back to barracks for supper, Prairie and I clearing up the dishes after. November 22nd. We were told when our brand gun carriers come in, we would be using them to patrol the border of Japanese-occupied China. Geeky and I went downtown on the bus, crossed on the ferry down to Hong Kong, saw some fine modern stores and buildings there, and double-decker streetcars. An Englishman in a car picked us up and drove us up the steep winding road to 15 Peak Mansions. His name is William F. Simmons. He was ordered by the government to send his wife and family to safety. They are now in Victoria, B.C. Wonderful view of the harbor from the peak. We had supper at the YMCA and took in a show at the Star Theater called A Guy, A Girl, and A Gob. Very funny. Vic Geeky is one of the finest men I've met in the Army. A wonderful sense of humor. November 23rd, Sunday. Instead of church parade, we are loading and unloading ammunition and cleaning brand guns, which are packed in grease. This Crown Colony of Hong Kong is greatly overcrowded owing to the influx of refugees from Canton as a result of the Chino-Japanese War. People sleep on the sidewalks here by the thousands. The surrounding hills are rapidly being denuded of their scrubby forest covering because fuel is so scarce for cooking fires. Talking to an Englishman who had been here for 19 years and appears to be very fond of the place, but he claims everything was better in every way in the good old days. Liquor was cheap and plentiful then, and all the maids were fair. Tonight, 56 men went to hospital. The meat was bad at supper. I did not partake of the viands as I had smelled it first. November 24th, 1921. Some of our men sent to the island. Weather is quite chilly. Showers are cold. 25th. A number of us were ordered to be ready to move to the island. Wilson got a telegram from Jamaica. November 26th, 41. Fell in. Marched to the ferry, sailed across the bay, landed, had a very steep climb up difficult hills to Wan Chai Gap, where we took up positions on the road at different points. Night raining and windy. 2 hours on and four off. 27th. Everything damp, including ourselves. There's a constant stream of natives toiling up these hills, cutting great bundles of ferns or brush and toiling down again with their burdens. 28th. Struck camp. There is a species of deer in these hills called the barking deer. They are quite small, only weigh about 40 pounds. They are preyed upon by packs of wild dogs that use these hills as a refuge. The leader of these packs is an Alsatian. In the hills on the mainland, wild boars still live. We returned to barracks in the mainland by supper time. November 29th, 21. Vic and I went downtown and, crossing the island, shopped around in the Emporium, a large modern departmental store. After supper, with Leach and Bob Grace, we were caught by a blackout and cessation of all traffic. Watched one plane come over, practicing dropping flares and tear gas bombs. It is payday today, so a wild night, a riot in the Sun Sun Cafe. 70 men of headquarters company still absent from quarters at 10 o'clock. November 30th, 1941. All men confined to barracks, carrying ammunition from central stores to company stores, ordered to pack kits. Rumors are rife that there has been a clash on the border during the night, etc. Dispatched riders are dashing about, and trucks and field pieces are starting up the mountain road toward the new territories. I mailed 7 Christmas cards today. Fatigue parties are loading magazines tonight. December 1st, 41, Monday. The Royal Scots loaned us one old Bren gun universal carrier, and we had a lecture on it. Each company sending a platoon to man posts on the island. December 2nd, 41. Vic is taking up a course to become a PT instructor. We have been allowed to take turns driving this old Bren gun carrier backwards and forwards with most emphatic cautions to be careful. Our officers are afraid we will break some parts and be charged with them before the carrier goes back to the Royal Scots. Our regimental charges are going up by leaps and bounds, nearly 9 Hong Kong dollars now. December 3rd, 41. Lectures on field signals for use in carriers. We have sections of men parading, pretending they are carriers. Then a lecture on poison gas. Some of our driver mechanics are working on the old carrier, hoping it will hold together so we can practice with it. December 4th, 41. Lessons in turning the carrier around without stalling it or killing the motor or throwing off track. December 5th, 41. lectures on new anti-gas equipment of cape and hood and detecting assembly of tippet and white and yellow paper slips. December 6, 41. We had a grueling session of squad drill under the lashing tongue of a certain lieutenant, the same squad drill we had performed at Mineral Armories in 39. Went out in the evening with Vic and saw a show called The Long Voyage Home. Crossed the island and went up to the peak on the cable car, 1,205 feet above sea level, in 8 minutes, at an angle of 45 degrees. It must have cost $1 million to put up the barracks in the peak. They are huge, massively constructed buildings. After descending, we went to the Queen Theater to see My Life with Caroline, starring Ronald Coleman. Very entertaining. December 7th, 41. Confined to barracks, all ranks, moving stores, loading ammunition, fell in after dinner, marched the ferry, landed, climbed the steep road to One Chai Gap, erected tents, then a brigadier ordered that the big marquee we had worked so hard to put up must come down. We could sleep in pup tents, but there were not enough, so most of us slept under the stars. We heard distant rumbles of artillery during the night. December 8, 41, Monday. We are at war with Japan. Just after breakfast, the sirens started to wail a warning. Then we heard planes, but could not see them. Then great water spouts, four in a row in the harbor, close to a big freighter. Our AK-AK opened up. On a wiring party last night and all day today. December 9th, 41. Worked all night moving stores from the mainland across by ferry and up in the hills. Then no place to put them out of the rain. Great quantity thrown on the ground. This continued throughout the day. Our old parade square was bombed, and the Jubilee building was hit. Some Chinese killed, and several of the Royal Rifles wounded. We are in road positions. It is raining, wet, and cold. December 10th, 46. We hear artillery fire from the mainland, where the Royal Scots and Middlesex are holding up the Jap advance. Imperials have fallen back to their second line of defense. Our meals are very scanty. December 11th, 41. While on night shift, we heard a whistle and scream as the first heavy artillery shell from the mainland reached our island. Counted 8 separate ones. An attempted invasion this afternoon by a fleet of junks from an island to our south was foiled by some of our gunboats who sank 7 of them and drove the rest away. An artillery duel going on now. 6 Jap bombers flew over at 3:35 and dropped bombs. Kowloon has been bombed. Some parts are burning. The echoes of the reports of the big guns rock and roll around these peaks like thunder. The air raid siren has been sounding almost constantly these days. Some of the boys have been raiding our stores, which are piled in the open, and we tasted our Christmas puddings a little earlier than usual. The quartermaster will be getting gray hairs thinking of the bales and boxes of clothes and shoes lying out in the rain. December 12, 41, on a wiring party all day. We heard that the U.S. had declared war on Germany, Italy, and Japan. December 13th. Heard that when the fleet of junks was invading, they got so close that 2 Starrett boys of A Company sunk several with Vickers fire. A number of 5th colonists have been caught quite close around here and taken blindfolded to headquarters, some disguised as coolies, some as ARP wardens. A launch came across from Kowloon, supposedly bearing a Jap delegation. December 14, 41. Quiet night. Heavy artillery this morning. A hit was made on the gasoline dump at the crossroads. It did not take fire, but is running away rapidly. Some of the boys have young beards. Heavy shelling this afternoon. Shrapnel dropping all around. The fragments are quite hot. Ugly, jagged pieces of metal. Quite a number of planes going over it, dropping bombs and propaganda leaflets at the same time. The literature is directed toward the Indian troops. A picture of John Bull on a suffering elephant. The cable has been sabotaged, so we are cut off except by radio. Parts of Kowloon burning. Very cold here during the night. Must be the altitude and the damp. December 15th, 41. Our water supply, very inadequate. We're lucky when we get 2 meals a day. A lot of Jap planes over. Relieved of our post, moved into a private house, number 555. A lovely house. The owner is gone, but his coat of arms is emblazoned over the mantelpiece. A shield with 2 dolphins in one upper corner, a diagonal bar with three fleur-de-lis on it and two linked rings below. But we had no chance to sleep. We worked all night filling sandbags and carrying them to build a barricade around the officer's orderly room. December 16th, 21. Food seems harder to get all the time. We have drawn our emergency iron rations, but were ordered not to touch them till we had been without food for 2 days. There is a small radio in this house. We heard some Christmas carols. Went out this evening, filled sandbags till 1 o'clock. December 17th, 41. Heard from an American station we were besieged on this island, but could hold out indefinitely. Rumors running around these hills that the Japs are proposing terms again. Heard tonight of a proposed raid on Lama Island. December 18th, 21. Project awaiting confirmation by the Brigadier. A huge fire down on the edge of Victoria City. An oil dump has been hit by the Jap bombs. A vast cloud of black smoke covering most of the sky and billowing ever upward. I can't bring myself to write what happened between the 18th and the 25th. All I can say is I saw too many brave men die, some were my best friends, and died beside me. When we were ordered to lay down our arms on Christmas Day, I was filled with huge disgust with everything. I gave my diary to Colonel Sutcliffe to keep for me. It's hard to put into words our feelings when we heard the governor of the colony had surrendered to the enemy. I saw some men break down and cry like children. What, surrender now? They sobbed after all the good men we've lost. We had 137 killed that we know of, for certain. Others cursed and raved as though delirious. Others, like myself, were stunned and dazed and apathetic. I never dreamed it could happen up to the last minute. Until Lieutenant Corrigan, the fighting Irishman, ordered us to lay down our arms. I had hoped, prayed, and yes, believed the miracle might happen. Surely there might be aid for us not so far away. What about all the rumors of Chiang Kai-shek leading a Chinese army down through the new territories? What about? Oh, well, here's one Lee Enfield that no Jap will ever use against us. I released the ball, clipped it out, and flung it into a deep rocky ravine about 200 feet below. Now we're prisoners of war at Mount Austin Barracks on December the 25th, 1941. Moved to Peak Mansions, 9:30 p.m., December the 26th. Then moved to Hong Kong University, December the 27th. Then moved to Victoria Barracks, December 28th. On December the 30th, 41, had an early breakfast of a half a cup of tea and a large spoonful of beans. Left Victoria Barracks about 7. Moved by slow stages down to the ferry where we saw a large number of bodies floating in the water. Ferried across and had a long roundabout march to Shamshupo Barracks where we found everything in a state of ruin and desolation. After we left, the Chinese had systematically looted and destroyed. The biscuits we slept on had been torn to pieces and the coir stuffing scattered everywhere. Not a window remained in a hut or a door. Even the brass faucets were gone, while the pipes had been torn out of the washrooms, and every scrap of wood that could be torn away from anything was gone, even the seats of the toilets. A scene of utter chaos, such as I never thought to see. Very short of rations. Tonight, each man got 3 hardtack crackers and 1/3 of a tin of bully. Some of the boys are sick. December 31st, 41. Spent a restless night, though bone tired. An Imperial Staff Sergeant lay outside, dying of an internal hemorrhage and calling for help. Some of his friends knelt beside him. They said he could not be moved. They carried him away in the morning when he was dead. Inside our hut, big, tiny Martin kept us all awake with a terrific cough. Each man got 3 hardtack crackers for breakfast, same for dinner. We're cleaning up the huts and the ground, sweeping up the broken glass and the shattered mortar and dirt and refuse of every description, the same as we did at Murray Barracks and the University and Victoria Barracks. Tonight we had our first taste of rice. There is a great pillar of smoke and a glare in the sky. It must be from the oil fire that has been burning for the past week. January 1st, 42. Quite cold in our windowless, doorless huts, very windy. Dust and ashes are swirling around from the remains of the rubbish fires, which are burning all day yesterday around our huts. Men are grouped around little cooking fires trying to boil water to make tea. A chill cheerlessness pervades the camp. some Chink peddlers trying to sell some native food through the wire. The sentries chased them away. The sun is shining, but it has no warmth. Corporal Fox has dysentery. Roll call 9:30. Breakfast, a cup of half-cooked rice without any salt. No dinner. My worldly goods are indeed few. I have the clothes I stand up in. One change of cotton underwear, one haversack and water bottle, and my steel helmet. My pack sack and all my personal belongings, plus my two kit bags, one of which contained $25 in Canadian money, are all over on the island, up among the peaks. Summit House number 555, Summit 529. Our rice tonight was only half-cooked, and yet it was burnt. Strange. Today, every man was asked his age and previous occupation. Very chilly this evening. January the 2nd, 1942. A very cold, miserable night, wrapped up in one blanket and oilskin gas cape, but shivered all night, everyone trying to find something to cover our windows. January 3rd, 42. Another shivery night. Major Baird gave us a pep talk, telling us not to get downhearted this morning. A Middlesex team beat the Royal Signals 4-0 at football. They must be eating better than we are. January 4th, 42, Sunday. Roll call at 8:30 and church parade at 12. Number of Indians are moving out of camp. We are going to get some of the coir they left behind and pick it over for our beds. The main topic of conversation is food. And once Walter Jenkins struck an attitude and declaimed, "You may live without books, what is knowledge but grieving? You may live without hope, what is hope but deceiving? You may live without love, what is passion but pining? But where is the man who can live without dining?" At the church parade, the Royal Scots Padre took the service. His text was, "Ye are they who came out of great tribulation." Hong Kong. The day never passed without the camp staff or the guards inflicting sheer, wanton cruelty on innocent Chinese civilians. The guards loved to practice jujitsu on 10-year-old boys, to make old women kneel for hours in the middle of the road at Shamshapo. While at North Point Camp, whenever any Chinese women attempted to gather firewood on the high hills above the camp, the guards used them for target practice, taking turns firing, laughing, and joking. The camp was on the very edge of the water. There was always a lot of small crafts in the bay. A small rowboat with two women in it came just within rifle range. A Jap officer was making his rounds. He seized a rifle from a guard and fired. One of the women dropped her oars and sank forward in the boat. The other rowed frantically to get out of range. Cold, calculated butchery, that's all it was. A Chinese girl of about 18 was tied to a tree for 2 days for gathering firewood close to camp. Close to Bone Road Hospital, two Chinese were wired to trees, soaked in waste oil and set on fire. Their screams were terrible to hear. Now we're prisoners of war back on the mainland at Shamshapo Barracks. January 5th, 1942. I got my diary back from the colonel this morning. Lack of personal kit is proving a great handicap and inconvenience. Few men have any soap or razors. The problem of feeding 5,000 men, Grenadiers, Royal Rifles, Royal Scots, Middlesex, Hong Kong Volunteers, Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery, the latter were all Hindus, all big men with turbans and bushy black beards, was a difficult one. Old gas drums had their heads knocked out or in. They were propped up on stones, a fire den underneath, and rice boiled that way, a cupful morning and night, no salt, a most insipid mess. The fortunate few who have money can buy over the fence from the Chinese a few things like buns and canned goods that really help. I'll never forgive myself for leaving $25 in my kit bag up among the hills on the island. We had a lecture from Major Baird. He advised us to make wooden clogs or sandals to save our shoes. The Imperials have all had a pay of $10 since the communist camp, but we haven't been paid a cent. January 6, 42. Japs put on a band concert. We were invited to attend or else. Not to be outdone, what was left of our band, along with the remainder of the Royal Scots Band, got together and played a few selections.
This afternoon, the Japs found a house nearby that contained a lot of furniture looted out of these barracks by the lower elements of the Chinese and ordered them to bring it back and throw it over the fence. Tables and chairs and fire pails, trunks, etc. A number of our men are going sick with dysentery. It is raining this morning, a mournful drizzle. January 7th, 42. The Indians digging a grave for one of their fellows who died during the night. There is a tremendous lot of traffic on the road that runs across the face of the hills behind our camp and up into the new territories. Traffic seems to run equally both ways, but the general belief is the Japs are taking everything of value out of this colony and forcing the Chinese to leave too. There were thousands of refugees here before hostilities began. They are worse off now than we are. Their plight is pitiful. All on foot, women and little children and babes in arms are climbing the steep, rocky road over the mountain. Their worldly goods in a bundle on their backs are tracing the same road down which they had fled not so long before, hoping for safety and protection from a brutal conqueror. What possible hope would they ever have of reaching Chinese-occupied territory? Ask the Imperials who knew this country what lay on the other side of the bare and rugged mountain range. Miles and miles of impassable swamp. Men make wars. Women and little children pay for them in untold suffering. January 8, 42, a cold night. McBride has 4 pieces of shrapnel in his head, but must wait for an x-ray before operation. Some of the Chinese troops escape, so now the Japs are forcing them to build for themselves a strong wire bullpen. When finished, they will be herded into it. January 9, 42. The camp is full of rumors. It's amazing the way men will repeat rumors that they know in their hearts are too good to be true. There's no place on earth so full of wishful thinking as a POW camp. It's like drowning men grasping at straws, or men repeating things as if by mere repetition they could make them come true, make facts out of fancies. The Japs are doing everything to discourage peddlers who sell around the fence. I saw a sentry administer a brutal beating to a 10-year-old kid who could hardly crawl away afterwards. January the side the fence, who beat up the peddlers. It is tantalizing to hear men talk of their favorite dishes while we dine on rice without salt, but it is exquisite agony to think of our people at home who have no way of knowing what happened to us. We hear our casualty list never went home, nor the letter each man wrote after capitulation. January 11, 42, Sunday. A service was held by the two Imperial Padres. The Padre of the Royal Scots urged us to put on the full armor of God and gather our hardihood around us and to count our blessings. I had a long talk with Dusty Dame. Sitting on the smooth cement of the tennis court in the sun with my pencil, I sketched the old farm quarter by quarter, field by field. A Japanese hospital ship is in the harbor with, they say, 9,000 wounded Japs from the Philippines. One report claims the Japs had 10,000 casualties in taking Hong Kong, 2,000 dead, 8,000 wounded. A big mule train went away up over the mountain trail at noon today. Rumor says the Japs are taking all metal from here, are not fortifying the place. We have no midday meal, not even tea, and we are forbidden to drink the water here without boiling it first. Private campfires have been forbidden to conserve fuel for the kitchen. All lights must be out at 9 o'clock. There are not many to extinguish, only 2 or 3 candles in each hut. January 12, 42. Saw a Jap sentry rope and tie a Chinese boy to a lamppost, then completely strip 2 Chinese women in order to publicly humiliate them. January 13. We had a few native beans in our rice today, but only half cooked. I think I miss bread and butter more than anything. January 14th.
The inveterate smokers are having a hard time to get tobacco, are picking up butts and stubs and snipes. January 15th. Officers betting on probable date of our release. A few beans in the rice tonight, pale yellow and rather hard. We hear freighters in the harbor can only get up the Pearl River as far as Canton. January 16th. We had 10 minutes of squad drill on the square, so we will not forget our basic training, I suppose. The Jap guards stared. January 17th. For several days, the Japs have been loading sacks of salt out of a big storehouse just outside our garrison onto their trucks and down to a ship. Big 60 cats with calves are coming in a steady stream down the mountain road, dragging big guns and heavy loads. I was on guard at the orderly room during the night, yet there was nothing there to guard but a few makeshift tables and brooms. Quite cold. Milton Dan hammered out a large piece of corrugated roofing and made a door for one end of the hut, riveted the hinges on. January 18th, 42. Cecil Fine's birthday. Went to church service and beginning to detest this monotonous diet, but must eat to live. There are two bodies floating past the wharf at the corner of our compound. They are floating face down. Their hands are tied behind their backs. January 19th. A few minutes of squad drill this morning. More prisoners came in who had been in hospitals. Firewood is very scarce. Rafters are being torn out of huts. No axes in camp, using picks and iron fence posts to split wood. Saw one of the Royal Rifles eating his rice out of a large ornamental hubcap off an automobile. January 20th. We did company drill for 15 minutes this morning. Herb Ballar came into camp from hospital. Wounded in his back, still open. Japs clearing all our wounded out of the hospital. 39 Jap ships in the harbor. Several truckloads of army stuff came into camp. The Indians nearly mobbed it, had to be driven off. A near riot between the whites and the Indians. Pickets out all night patrolling between the lines. January 21st. A new staff in the kitchen. A certain staff sergeant let out of the kitchen as he was found feasting during the night on hardtack and butter. January 22nd. Some Indians moving out today. Imperials playing cricket on the parade ground. Guards are maintained on the kitchen all night. January 23rd. Canadians moving out of this camp. The Imperials swarming into our huts as we vacate them and dragging off our few iron beds. After counting and recounting by the Japs, we start at 10, march and forge through Kowloon, cross the island on the ferry, see many sunken boats on the way over with parts of their funnels or smokestacks showing. Reach North Point Camp, wait while some of the Imperials and Chinese volunteers march out to make room for us. What is left of the Royal Rifles are here. We see some of our men we had given up for lost. Many of these huts damaged by shell fire. The flies are bad. Dysentery is prevalent. We are right on the shoreline here. Food a little better, a little bully beef and some hardtack. January 24th, a severe lecture. Warned to have our beards off in 24 hours, though very few men have razors and are not anxious to land. We were told any breach of discipline would be severely dealt with by loss of pay, detention, or field punishment. The beds are old, wooden double-deckers, not enough to go around. Shove two together and cram three men on top and three in the bottom. Some Dutchmen came into camp tonight, captured off a sub on the 19th of December. Took all this time to get here in a tramp hugging the coast. January 25th. I prayed to find out how many native-born Canadians we had. Now the rumors are flying there may be an exchange of prisoners. The Navy played the Army at football. The Rifles played the Grenadiers at softball. Roll call in PT at 10:30. Another roll call at 2:30. Another period of PT. These will be compulsory every day from now on. During the night, there were several bursts of machine gun fire, evidently designed to drive away marauding Chinese from the partly submerged wrecks that litter the harbor. The flies are fierce in this camp. We are forbidden to eat in our huts, as it may draw the flies in more. The guards here change every hour. Cooks are trying to bake bread in the kitchen, but lack proper ovens. January 28th. An officer in camp has made a bet we will be home for Easter. Quite a commotion in camp tonight. Five Navy men have escaped, and it is believed they actually left sometime last night, supposedly in a whaler propelled by sails. All ordered into huts, and a thorough check of all camp personnel made. January 29th. A muster at Ravalli and another roll call at 10:30. A few men who try to light little fires for themselves are strictly discouraged. A rumor we may be exchanged for jets on the West Coast or further fishing fleet. January 30th. The Navy men in here seem to have lots of money. The sentry sell them cigarettes and chocolate bars. January 31st. Kit inspection, a hollow mockery. Some men were searched for officers' clothes and equipment. A great many bets are on as to when we will be free. A pool has been formed. The guesses range from May the 1st to 45. Reading Down the Garden's Path by Beverly Nichols. One of the best I've read for some time. The guard was changed today. An open-air concert tonight. Our band played. The crew of the Dutch sub sang their national anthem and the sub song and the song of the sea. February 1st. A rumor Chinese guerrillas are active on the mainland. Small meals today. A lot of hungry men. February 2nd. I dreamed I was home last night kissing Isabel, my youngest sister. I wish now I'd kissed her oftener when I had the chance. February 3rd. Wild rumors about exchange of prisoners. Some fellows, for a hobby, are whittling or carving. Some are collecting badges and fixing them on their belts. Moved all the beds outside, scrubbed both beds and huts. Half of each double rafter is being removed from each hut. This camp was originally built to house Chinese refugees. A queer mist drifting on the harbor's night. Sentries firing on the peddlers around the fence. A short lecture from Lieutenant Commander Gasper on his experience with Chinese maritime customs in checking smugglers off the coast. A Canadian caught by a sentry buying through the fence had face slapped and goods confiscated before being taken to the camp commandant. A rumor, some whole meat came into camp. C Company tried to start the small newspaper, several sheets of typewritten matter, which is tacked on the wall of Hut 20. We did not get any meat, but a little gravy. And as Jenkins said, where there's gravy, there's always meat. So someone got it. February 4th. We have a half-hour PT every forenoon. Two Chinese have been shot and one bayonet by the Jap for selling stuff to the defense. A little whale soup tonight. Drizzling rain. February the 5th. Overcast, cold, showery. Reading Salute to Adventure by Buchan. Very good. For supper, a sauce made from sweet potatoes. February 6th. Someone outside has loosed an occasional shot at our guards during the night. There is a blackout on the mainland and the island. Cars have blue cloths over the headlights. February 7th. Another incident, a sentry is being fired on at a corner where they stood under a light. A lot of men have taken to chewing the pitch or tar used for roofing. The tar is used for patching the shrapnel holes in the roof, and it keeps leaking through on the beds. The men are warned at every parade to spit out all their tar before they come on parade. February the 8th. Dark, lowering clouds drizzling drearily on Kitchen Fleek with old Bill Harkness, who used to work for the pre-president. Outdoor kitchen, smoky open fires, suit, puddles and pools everywhere, chilly, clothes wet. February 9th, trying to get some dental work done, no luck. February 10th, another gray day, the Japs are chanting to their sun god and doing PT. They really work at it. 24 grenadiers came into camp today from Queen Mary's and St. Teresa's hospitals. Alex Kabinski says, a lot of our dead are still lying unburied around One Chai Gap. We hear that Eric Anderson's leg was saved after all. A miracle. Dilemmas. Rained heavily during the night, bleak and cheerless today. Some bricks, barrels, and stovepipes came in today to aid in building a kitchen. A hospital ship with the Red Cross on the arrive today, probably loaded with wounded from Singapore. 12th. Cloudy, cold, raining. One of the boys is reading Revelations and striving to prove that Hitler will only endure 40 and 4 months from the outbreak of his dominance, which should mean his fall this summer. A lot of the men are getting lousy. No soap, no hot water. Most of the men have no greatcoats and walk around with their blankets around their shoulders. 13, Cloudy and Cold, a hot argument between Sergeant Payne and Sergeant Watson on capitalism versus labor. Ravenously hungry. February the 14th, raining again. Hospital here is crammed full, 30-odd patients. Latest figures on our casualties are 137 dead or missing. There are 719 in this camp now, probably at the same number of rifles. Quite a number of the Royal Navy and the crew of the Dutch sub. The grounds here are less than a quarter the size of Hampshire Pole. Today we were warned to turn in all cameras. I haven't seen a single one in camp. February 15, 1942. Sick as a dog. Couldn't touch food all day. February 16, 42. Went into hospital dysentery. So-called hospital was an old warehouse. No windows in the east or south. Dank concrete walls and floor. Roof supported by six huge stone columns. Reminds me of Byron's description of the prisoner of Chillon. There is a makeshift stove here, but it will not draw. It gives more smoke than heat. 17th. Rumor is rife that Singapore has fallen. They drench us with Epsom salts five times a day as if we were horses. 18th. Rained heavily during the night. The rats scurry around our pallets in the darkness. 19th. Temple came in today. When they opened the door to get rid of the smoke from the stove, they chilled the whole room. 20th. Rainy night, gray, cold day. Was given a bit of hardtack. It was certainly tasted good. Cecil Fiennes visited me. He has been very kind, both in Champchapeau and here. 22nd, a gray, cold day. Some more hardtack. Some of the boys are taking a bath in a basin tonight. 23rd, milder, still overcast. This afternoon, nine of us, including old Alf Johnson and myself, were loaded in the back of a truck and taken to Bowen Road Military Hospital. It was shelled during the war and damaged badly in parts. The connecting covered bridge between the two main buildings being gutted by fire. Only the ceiling looks bad in our ward. Much of the plaster's off, at least when it rains. I had a hot bath in a real bathtub and got into a bed with sheets. Wonderful. A Royal Rifle, the next caught to me, is very ill with dysentery. His name is Lowell, from Bury, Quebec. February 24th, 42. Actually had two slices of bread for breakfast and some tea. I could not eat any dinner. We are quite high up in the hills here. A number of grenadiers who are convalescing from wounds dropped in to say hello to me. It turned very cool and raw. Green was buried at 5 this afternoon. 26th. Cold and very foggy. We hear occasional rifle shots. The sentries are shooting pigeons. A naval officer says the Japs have a division of troops, 12,000 men, guarding this colony. About 4,000 British civilians have been interned on Stanley Island across from Repulse Bay. This is fine, thanks. This is just fine, thanks. We had that cuttlefish for dinner. I could not stomach it. The suction discs on the tentacles gave me the creeps. The 27th, very raw and cold. Some nurses here. I was given a thick crust of bread for breakfast. Very grateful for it. I am reading The Good Companions by J.B. Priestley. Very good book. February 28th, 1942. Still cold. This place has as many wild rumors circulating through it as camp. The latest is that Britain has granted independence to India. March 1st, 42. Still raw and cold. There are 11 patients in this ward. March 2nd, 42. Some Indian ghee on our bread. Ghee is spelled G-H-E-E. It's very similar to dripping. March 3rd, 42. A big helping of rice for dinner as a mistake was made when we drew rations for Ward 6, who have more patients than ours. Quite a number of patients who were discharged from hospital and waiting in the barrack block went down today back to North Point or Champchapeau. March 9th, 42. We each had a boiled egg for breakfast. Some couldn't eat theirs. Mine was stale and musty, but I choked it down. Heard there is a lot of beriberi in North Point. March 5th, 42. My morning egg was rotten.
The first warm, sunny day for some time. I sat out on the balcony for an hour this afternoon. A very skimpy supper. Two wafer-thin slices of bread and a half an ounce of cheese. March the 6th, 42. Walked down three flights and had a much-needed haircut. Sat in the sun after dinner. Tonight I was weighed. 136.25 pounds. Left Canada weighing 168. March the 7th, 42. Cold and dismal again. No sun. A few beans this morning. An egg tonight. Read one of Hawking's books. March the 8th, 42. Roll call at 9 every morning now by order of the Japs. This forenoon, some Jap officers brought in a Chinaman who accused the sergeant major, who is a patient here, of bearing arms and ammunition on the hospital grounds. The sergeant major indignantly denied the charge. This seems to be a popular method among the Chinese to curry favor with the Japs. Our eggs were rank tonight. The moment we broke the shell, we knew they were rotten. March 9th. A few beans for breakfast. Finished reading Sons of the Others by Philip Gibbs. Very good. An egg tonight. Very strong, but forced down. March 10th, 42. Raining and cold. Went to the dentist. Captain Fraser, very decent fellow. Still has a strong Scotch accent. Octopus for dinner. It was horrible. The truck came up from North Point with more patients. One duck egg for supper. March 11th, 42. Soap is terribly scarce and very hard to get. It makes bathing and laundry difficult indeed. Salt is hard to get. We miss it greatly. March the 12th, 42. Talking to Eric Anderson, who got a bad dose of shrapnel in both legs and one arm. He is remarkably cheerful, though both legs are in a cast from toes to the knees. He has the highest praise for the two Canadian nurses who work here. They came over with us on the Awatia. Miss Kathleen Christie, I should say Lieutenant, and Lieutenant May Waters. We had a short concert in one ward. March the 13th, Friday. Weighed again, 134.5 pounds. Very dense fog during the night. Even the harbor lights obscured. Read The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck, a sordid, tragic story. The Ides of March, misty but clearing up, two discharged from our number 7 ward. I talked to Benny Newfield for a while. He lived near Morden once, 12 in his family. Father came from Nebraska. They used to kill 4 pigs and an ox every fall to see them through the winter. His mother had a famous recipe for baked beans. It makes us all the hungrier to talk about these things, but we can't help it. March the 15th, 42, a practice fire drill. A wild rumor that 4,000 Canadians landed in Australia to protect it against threatened invasion. March the 16th, 42, kit inspection by the Japs. They seized all flashlights and all medical or technical books. Low, one of the rifles from Bure, Quebec, up for a few hours a day. We are getting 8 ounces of bread per day. Reading The New Road by Neil Munro. Very good historical novel. The Japs have had 2 Chinamen tied to posts by their guard room down on the road below this hospital for a day and a night. We are only allowed hot water for washing 2 days a week now. March the 17th, 42. Today was Eric Anderson's birthday. I had quite a visit with him down his ward on ground floor. He was drawing plans for a house and a barn he would like to build after the war. We had cuttlefish for dinner. It was horrible. March the 18th, 42. Working all forenoon, sweeping, washing, and polishing in preparation for inspection by the new Japanese governor of the colony. He never even walked through our ward. It's simply because the Japs are deadly afraid of our dysentery. Talking to Ganton, his arm in a cast. He is planning a cooperative farm on a large scale in B.C. after the war. March the 19th. 3 cases from North Point went into Ward 6 today, 2 with malaria, and Roger Leach with beriberi. He is all puffed up from the straight rice diet. March 20th, 42. I'm hungry all the time, day and night. I help carry rations regularly from the kitchen now. I read The Glen of Weeping by Marjorie Bowen, a tragic story about the massacre of Glencoe. March 21st. Washed up the dishes after every meal now. Dropped in for a few minutes' chat with Leach in Ward 6 and Anderson in 9. For the first time, the rice was cooked dry and increased from 3 to 5 ounces. March 22nd, fine weather for once. March 23rd, a little Indian ghee, spelled G-H-E-E, on our bread this morning. It's a sort of dripping. It seems more filling than butter. An Indian artilleryman died of his wounds today after lingering for months. He was buried on the steep hillside. Kellaway of the Rifles, who died here, was just 19 the day before he died. Sergeant Peller just came in with tonsillitis. March the 24th, reading Hood's poems today. Heard a large convoy had reached Australia from the U.S. True or false? March 25th, the Japs are tearing down the statues in Monument Square of Victoria and Edward and melting them down for the bronze. March 26th, a spoonful of soy sauce, dark brown, sour and salty, on a rice at noon. Any flavor is better than none. Four more patients in from North Point. One was Major Crawford. Read Wild Animals I've Known by Ernest Thompson Seton. I have not read it since I was going to school at Paramount. March the 27th, gained a pound last week. March the 28th, Eric had another operation on his leg and had a piece of infected bone taken out. March 29th, reading one of Churchill's novels, A Modern Chronicle, published in 1910. Cloudy, raining tonight. March 30th, raining, roof leaking. Hens, eggs today, far more rotten than the ducks. March the 31st, 42, cold and rainy, a rehearsal for a concert tonight. Some patients are going on stretchers. Dark in our ward. One bulb when there should be at least three. The roof leaking and the place is a cheerless air. Hungry, restless, and my feet are very cold. April 1st, actually had a concert tonight, but all too short. April the 2nd, 42, told today to move to block as has been countermanded. 15 men left it today for Shamshapole. I was put in a working party this afternoon, given a shovel, and told to fill up a huge bomb crater. Two slices of dry bed for supper. The barrack block is a large, dirty, untidy building, 13 of us in it. April 3rd, general cleanup. April 4th, we had two small, thin slices of bread dipped in peanut oil and fried for breakfast. Very good. On a working party today, pick and shovel, fill in craters and shell holes. Hard work. I do not feel up to it yet. Headache and backache. General weakness. April 5th, bad attack of diarrhea, or is it a relapse of the dysentery? Up 9 times during the night. This morning, went to the Easter service. April 6th, dull and rainy. Warned to be ready to leave for North Point. As soon as we had packed, we were told the move was canceled. I started to read Oliver Wistwell by Kenneth Roberts, a splendid historical novel. There are 836 pages. I wonder if I will have time to finish it. Afraid not. April 7th, Tuesday. Heard this morning that Colonel Sutcliffe died last night at 7 o'clock of malaria, dysentery, and anemia. I think myself he died of a broken heart. The funeral was at 4 in the afternoon. Two truckloads of officers and CSMs came up from North Point to pay their last respects.
Can we stop there, please? I'd like to
say.
Do you want to try one?
No, thanks. No.
Do you want to analyze one? They are just salt tablets.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
That's all they are.
Yeah.
And I just use them when I get hoarse. And that is in the prescription book that I got from Deer Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Marsh is my doctor.
Right.
And now, if you want to, I'll try to sing one of the songs that one of these. I'll explain. These concerts they tried to put on in Bone Road, the same fellows would get up every time and they would give the same things over and over. So we finally got to know them off by heart. And there was two from the men from the Hong Kong Volunteer Defense Corps,
They were had originally been in the South African War and in the First World War. And one of them sang a song. It was called, and it's just a few verses. And do you want me to sing
sure.
right now?
Sure.
Now, this, do you want to turn on this?
Yeah, it's on.
It's on.
It's going.
Oh, it's on. Well, pardon me. This is a song sung by a veteran of the South African War, and he sang it so often that we finally got to know it off by heart, but we always applauded. We always applauded. We just gave him everything we had from the audience, you know. And he was an old man. But this is the way it went. Pardon me. Now, Bertie was a very awkward soldier. Though he was his mother's pride and joy, on the barrack square, the sergeant, in despair, shouted, "Bertram, you're a very naughty boy." Then Bertie thought of home and mother dear, and went and whispered in the sergeant's ear, "Don't be angry with me, sergeant. Don't say what you were going to say. Don't be angry with me, sergeant. Don't call me what you called me yesterday. Don't say rude things about my parents. Remember, they're the only ones I've known. And someday, even though you are a sergeant, you may have some parents of your own." Bertie cried all down the sergeant's tunic, cried all down his chest protector, too. Tears fell here and there, soaked his underwear, till sergeant hollered, "Blimey, I'm wet through." Then all the privates, standing side by side, pulled out their pocket handkerchiefs and cried, "Now let's pretend we're in the army, drilling on the dear old barrack square. You're the old brigade. I've got you on parade. I'm a tough old sergeant, can I swear. You've got to learn to win my sympathy, so try to sing this little song with me. Don't be angry with me, sergeant. Don't say what you were going to say. Don't be angry with me, sergeant. Don't call me what you called me yesterday. Don't say rude things about my parents. Remember, they're the only ones I've known. And someday, even though you are a sergeant, you may have some parents of your own." And there was another veteran of the South African War who gave this little selection. "I am an old soldier. My hair is gray. My memory is not bad, though I'm 60 today, or else 62. Can't be 64. Well, maybe it is, but it's not a day more. Let's see, I was born in, I can reckon it up now. Tut, tut, this confusion makes me quite upset. I'm 80, I think. I forget. My only loved one was a girl named Elaine. Elaine, or Priscilla. No, perhaps it was Jane. However, one evening, my head in a whirl, I called on her father and asked for the girl. Now, did he consent in a tone of regret? Or say, 'Take the three.' I forget. I first joined the army in 1710. No, that can't be right, for I wasn't born then. 'Twas in 1803. Wrong again, it was not. That's somebody's telephone number I've got. They asked me what regiment I'd like to choose. Would I join the Hussars? I said, no, the who's who. 'Twas with General Buller we captured DeWitt. Or did he capture us?
I forget. Well, I get very old, and I'm not so much use in the army, I'm told, though I still jog along. The days come and go. And long for the day, which is coming, I know, when we hear the dread call, which comes from the greatest commander of all. Then whatever there be in the past to regret, when I hand up my sword, I just hope he'll forget. Well, you might as well hear the one Navy song that was sung over and over by the Navy personnel. You might as well.
Sure.
You might as well. After all, the Navy deserves some recognition, even in the concert. actually, you've heard these before, have you?
No.
You're sure?
Yes.
Well, stop me if you heard this before. Now, my comrades, you must know, it was many years ago when I left my father's cabin in the Greenwood, oh. I joined a man of war and became a jolly tar and fought for king and country on the high seas, oh. Then a pull, boys, merrily, the wind is passing by. Pull, boys, merrily and lightly, oh. Pull, boys, cheerily, the wind is passing free, and it's whirling up the foaming waters sky high, oh. We saw many a gallant sight, but Trafalgar was the fight, where we fought like Greeks and Romans in their glory, oh. There England's gallant sons worked their thunder-blazing guns, and Nelson stood the bravest on the forefront, oh. Now there came a cannon shot, and it hit the very spot where my leg was crick-a-jimbo in the socket, oh. And it swept it overboard with the precious little hoard of pipe and tin and baccy in the pocket, oh. Then they took me down below, and they laid me in a row of dead and dying men on a table, oh. Then down comes Dr. Keg and says, here's a living leg. I'll sew it on the socket if I'm able, oh. Now that good and trusty limb had belonged to Fighting Jim, and scarcely had he sewed it on the socket, oh. When up the hatch I flew, and I dashed among the crew, and I sprang aboard the Frenchman like a rocket, oh. Now true Britons all do say that that leg it won the day, for the battle raged like fury while it lasted, oh. And when ceased the shot and shell, and the fall upon the swell, and the Union Jack went bravely to the masthead, oh. Then pull, boys, merrily, the wind is passing free. Pull, boys, cheerily and lightly, oh. Pull, boys, merrily, the wind is passing free, and it's whirling up the foaming waters sky high, oh. Well, these concerts were a break in the monotony, and no matter how sick a man was, they'd put him on a stretcher and they'd carry him in this one ward where the concert was being held. And the maddening thing was, about every second concert, we'd just start, and the Jap camp commandant would walk in and cancel the concert. Just for pure spite, that's all. But it was a wonderful break in the monotony, a marvelous break in the monotony, just to have those makeshift concerts. Yeah. Well, And I'll continue. Here we've had the death of Colonel Sutcliffe, and now we're back we're about to leave Bournemouth Hospital, April 8, 1942. We were all searched for fear we might have some hospital equipment, towels or dishes, as many coveted the big white bowls in use here, who had to eat out of tin cans at the camp down below. After supper, we left here for North Point Camp. April 9th, back at North Point Camp, we had a sort of sauce made out of Chinese dates on a rice. I went on sick parade and got excused duty for a week. April 10th, very hot down here compared to the temperature up in the hills at Bone Road. We had a stew made out of wild Chinese lettuce, quite flat and tasteless. Mosquitoes are very bad around here at night. Very hard to sleep. Buns are sourdough. Very sour, flat, and heavy. No yeast. Hard as rock on the outside. Sticky and doughy inside. April 8th. Footwear is a very serious problem. Some men wearing wooden sandals. But the majority are handicapped by lack of tools. April 13th. I finally finished a pair. Very uncomfortable to wear. April 14th. The Japs are salvaging all the sunken ships in the harbor, raising them, pumping them out, and stripping them. The double-decker tram cars are running past camp again. April 15, 42. The fence around our enclosure is being made higher, more barbed wire strung around us. Big Jap inspection of huts and grounds. April 16, clear and hot. Japs putting porcelain insulators on the fence posts and stringing four heavy smooth wires inside the barbed wire. April 17th, raining this afternoon. We hear the Navy men, 600 of them, are moving out of here tomorrow, and the 75 Canadians from Sham Chapeau are coming to take their place. Some of our men are selling kit bags to the sailors. For a long time, there has been dealing going on. Our men are selling buns to the Navy men for 3 cigarettes apiece. Tonight, now that darkness has fallen, our men are shamelessly pillaging around the Navy huts, picking up and carrying off everything movable in the way of stools, chairs, table, loose lumber. It's very sad. Before it got dark, they were buying them. April 18th, a heavy sky, drizzle with a gusty wind drive behind it. Miserable day for the Navy to move out. They're busting about, some staggering under huge packs, guards posted on the key of the huts to prevent looting. The Navy spent an hour in the parade square in the rain while their packs are being searched. The first casualty on the charged wire occurred this morning. It was the Jap orderly sergeant's own pet dog. We had thought of testing the current with Halbert's pet monkey. There was a whole crowd of starving Chinese waiting around this dead dog to be lifted off the hot wire. And the moment that the current was turned off and the Jap sentry came along and left, they had fixed bayonets all the time, and he used his bayonet to lift the dog off the charged wire. The moment he lifted it off, there was 20 or 30 Japs, Chinese, just grabbed that dog and they practically tore it to pieces and made off with it. Because there is no doubt the Chinese refugees were starving to death. They were. There's no doubt about it. And this afternoon, 80 Canadians came in from Argyle and Champ Chapeau. 20 of them were grenadiers. Among them, Dick Wilson, Alec Calvin, McCauley, and Sergeant Mars. April the 19th, a gray rainy day, special muster parade. The 20th. All the sergeants moving into one hut. There ought to be some good fights in there. A dozen Canadians came into camp from Bourne Road. The 21st, gray and cloudy, picked up enough scraps of wire around the fence to join together to make a clothesline. Opened up a rice sack and made a sort of hammock bed to replace the hard boards. Some landscape gardening going on in camp. RQMS Beer presiding over rations, and rice has been cut. We only get 3/4 of what we did. Fish sauce tonight so vile we could not eat it. April 23rd,
1942, a great day, our first issue of soap, one small bar of Life Boy divided between 12 men. April 24th, 42. I am reading Cheating Death by John Young. I only hope I can manage it. A mess of boiled lettuce for dinner. April 25th. Cloudy with showers. Every night the rats run through the huts. Jenkins says they're waiting till we get a little weaker before attacking us. April 26th, my birthday. One sourdough bun and a cup of bitter tea. My birthday supper, a half portion of rice with a little whale gravy and a small patty, actually made of whale meat and burnt rice, but mostly burnt rice. April the 27th, raining steadily. Reading The House of the Four Winds by John Bunyan. Some boiled eggplant sauce tonight. We were issued a spoonful of salt per man. April 29th, an issue of laundry soap, about 1 inch by 2 inches per man. The Japs are supervising the laying of some new foundation in camp. There is some argument among our men as to whether it is a new pillbox or a latrine. The Japs beat the Chinese coolies something cruel as they work. May 1st, lost 2 pounds last week. The afternoon roll call has been changed to 7:30 in the evening owing to some man collapsing in the heat. May 2nd, a Jap prince touring the colony ordered to stay in our huts while he passed the camp. The Japs have built a high lookout post on top of one of our huts. There's always a sentry up there with a pair of field glasses. We are warned by the Japs to expect air raids. We had to practice trial blackout tonight. May 7th. A movement is underway here to have 10 men from this camp each speak for 1 minute over the radio to Canada. I may be one of the 10. Our script is to be censored first by our officers and then by the Japanese, so we will not likely recognize it when they are finished. May 9th. I was put on a gardening project with a number of others. The Jap sentries must be short of relief. They are practically asleep on their feet, eyes closed, heads nodding. Japs went past in trucks with green foliage camouflage on their helmets. May 11th, out in the working party, 25 of our outfit and 25 Royal Rifles working on an acre and a half plot, preparing it for garden. It is gravel and clay, very stony. We are spading it and picking the stones, carrying down good earth from the hillsides and putting it in long, narrow trenches in which to grow our seeds. May 13th, we had a small portion of beef stew for supper. It comes so seldom, it's a great shock to us. May 14th, raining heavily. Japs held some artillery practice and experimented with smoke screens. We got very wet working in the garden. The Jap sentries are holding target practice by firing on Chinese gathering wood in the hillside. They used all our jiu-jitsu holds on a Chinaman on the road just outside our camp until he was senseless, and then they bayoneted him. When we carried our garden tools up the hill to store them away at Jap headquarters for the night, we saw another young Chinese girl, about 18, tied to a tree in the middle of the yard. May 16th, great scarcity of firewood in our kitchen. Reading In Chancery by Galsworthy. A battalion of Japs are engaged in practicing landing maneuvers with large motorized barges, troops swimming through the smoke screens to the shore, some artillery and machine gun fire. There are Japs taking movies of this whole thing. May 17th, a very hot night, and mosquitoes very bad. Buns were musty at dinner and moldy at supper. Had worms, bugs, and dirt in them. Heard that 6 of the kitchen staff are being yanked out. Some fools scribbled their names on the new latrine, and the Japs threatened to tie them to a post for 12 hours in the heat of the sun. May 18th, torrential rains today. May 19th, rained all night and all day. May 20th, rain again. Some very bad flowering, musty and dirty. Our buns are nearly black and taste horrible. We're supposed to be getting 10 ounces of rice per day. Downey figures we're being fed on 10 cents a day. Yet our government allows $1 a day. What will become of the difference? May 22nd, showers all day. A little gravy for supper tonight. Where does the meat go? May 23rd, torrential rain during the night. After dinner, we were all drawn up in the square, and with the aid of an interpreter, the camp commandant told us we must swear we would not attempt to escape while being held prisoner. This was an order from the Imperial Japanese Army, and if we did not comply, we would be severely dealt with. All the English Imperials had signed already, including General Maltby. And when our officers signed, we signed to because it is not a binding oath that will hold in any court of law because we signed under duress. We were compelled also, but we did not swear on the Bible. May 27th, very hot, no tea, and the drink water is lukewarm and so full of chlorine it upsets our stomachs every time we taste it. May 28th, restless night, mosquitoes, very bad, very hot today. The roofs of our huts were mended with tar to fill up the shrapnel holes. Now the heat of the sun is melting the tar. It dripped through onto our beds, blankets, and clothes. Everyone seems to have tar on the seat of their pants. May 29th, there seems to be some movement on foot regarding writing home. A long list of restrictions regarding the writing of letters has been posted up on the bulletin board. Very little to eat today, but the heat helps to dull my appetite, although it increases my thirst. Missed the tea terribly. May 31st, we were issued a shirt, a pair of shorts, and a tunic, all old and dirty. June 1st, a 20% cut in our rations makes our meals look mighty slim. Big event was a cup of tea, black and bitter, but tasting good after lukewarm chlorinated water. The hut drew lots to see who would write home first. June 2nd, 130 men drew lots for 8 mosquito nets. I was not lucky. The men who wrote home have had their letters returned to them and told they must rewrite them, shorten them to 200 words, and not ask for a single thing. June 3rd, Kulnshari. 5 rifles and 5 grenadiers, including Brigadier Holmes and Major Bailey and myself, took a trip today by bus to the dock, ferried over to Kowloon's side, took another bus and rode 4 or 5 miles to the Jap headquarters on the Kowloon's side at Argyle Street near St. Teresa's Hospital. We each spoke a short message into a microphone and a recording was made. Then the records were played back to us. It is our hope that they will be broadcast, picked up, and relayed till eventually they reach Canada. We left camp at 12:30. Did not get back till 5. Missed dinner. All the Japs gave us at headquarters was 2 cups of pale, weak, green tea, no cream, no sugar. My people never heard a word from me till July the 31st of 1944, when 2 letters arrived. One had been written in North Point Camp in 42, one in Japan in 43. My radio broadcast was picked up and sent to my people by 3 people in the United States and 1 in South Africa on October the 20th, 1944. Why did the Japs wait from June 3rd, 42, till October 20th, 44 before broadcasting? May 23rd, one of the rifles, Royal Rifles, an old man with white hair who refused to sign that he would escape, that he would attempt to escape. He was taken out of camp. He came back a week later. He had been starved and beaten every day till in the end he was forced to sign. June 4th, men have been ordered to shine their shoes or what is left of them. PT is before breakfast now. A grim paragraph has appeared in battalion orders that anyone who wishes to make his will may do so now. Japs have given us numbers of their own now. Mine is 5163. We must wear them on our shirts. Wild rumor sweeping through camp today that Germany has fallen. No buns today. 1/2 cup of vegetable soup for dinner. June the 8th, the heavy lashing rain. Our hut roof is leaking like a sieve, right over my bed. Tigers on this island. 1 killed, 4 still loose. Another issue of Life Boy, each bar to be divided between 12 men. June 9th, quite windy, white caps in the harbor. There's 1 large ship close to camp that the Japs have been trying to raise for the last 2 months. They have pumped day and night this last week. It is gradually rising. They have cables to the shore to keep it from rolling over. June 10th. This morning, the ship is down again, apparently sunk during the night. June 11th, 42. We were ordered to turn in all our bed boards. The Japs pumped the ship out today, and it really rose out of the water. June 12th. The ship sank overnight. Two men, very sick with dysentery, were finally granted permission by the Japs to go to Bone Road Hospital. Loaded on the back of the truck, one died on the way, the other died just after arriving. I wrote my letter home today. Officers and CSMs are betting we will be free in August. June 13, 42. Sidney Varco fainted dead away on roll call this morning before breakfast. The Japs are working again all night on the sunken ship. June 14th, they have raised it this morning, the highest yet. June 15th, 120 men went on a working party to Kai Tak to enlarge the airport there. It is on the mainland. They carried one bun each for the midday meal. June 16th, heavy rains and leaking roofs. Roll call inside the huts. Thank you. June 18th, RPT is a pretty grueling affair before breakfast. Sun is hot and our heads are bare. Have some very interesting discussions with Old Coles from Swan River and Bill Adams, who used to work for Skinner at Dropmore. Both are good gardeners. This afternoon, the Japs finally towed away the ship they had worked on for so long. June 20th, I was one of a large party who went out to the Kai Tak airport field on the Kowloon side, working with pick and shovel and handling crushed stone and bags of cement. Just before we left to go back, we were served with zuki beans cooked with sugar. They are small and black and taste like a pea, like peas. Not unaccustomed to anything sweet for so long, most of the boys couldn't keep them down. They threw them up after eating them. We are very tired tonight. June 22nd, a big shake up in the kitchen. One fellow up an order, so he implicated everyone he could and dragged the other down the ruin with himself. A scurvy trick. June 23rd. Tonight, the working party coming in complained of not enough to eat and being roughly treated by the guards. June 24th. Some firing during the night. A bullet ricocheted through camp. June 25th. Planes flew over dropping leaflets. Rumor says there was something about Harbin in Manchuria, but no one knows for certain. I was one of a party of 39 sent to Bone Road Hospital to cut grass and bushes around the electrically wired fence to prevent current from being grounded. We alternate daily with the Royal Rifles sending 200 men to work on the airport. June 27th, working on the airport in the rain, drenched to the skin, shoveling crushed rock and mixing cement. July 22nd, have been out working every second day since work began. July 3rd, a big inspection of camp and huts. We were drawn up on the square. Two men in civilian clothes were with the Jap staff. They say one was the Swiss consul. A heavy rain again. For dinner, one bun and a cup of greasy water with a little grass in it. July 4th, we got our first Japanese pay for working on the airport. 30 sen worth $5.10 in Canadian currency. The bed bugs are getting worse. I am reading The Tudor Wench by Elspeth Thane, the story of Elizabeth. The small makeshift detention barracks here will not hold all the men under sentence. There's a long waiting list, enough to keep it full till Christmas. July 10th. Rained heavily during the night, still raining. Work party canceled as airfields almost flooded. Warned to fasten all doors and windows as typhoon is expected. Reading Colonel Bramble by Andre Moroy. Very entertaining. July 11th, clearing up. The storm must have passed, though there were warning lights and towers throughout the city last night. July 11th, Japs are building a high watchtower inside our enclosure. Rain, day after day. The roofs leak badly. The sergeants have their own meals now. July 16th, incessant rain, very depressing. July 20th, more rain. Three vessels with USSSR on their sides were towed past here last night. USSR on their sides. Today, two barges that were in use by the seawall, equipped with cranes, sank. They're being pumped out, and the diver's working down around them. Four men are pumping air down to him. More rain. July the 22nd, rain every day. Arguments rage here day and night on every conceivable subject under the sun. In here, it is hard to find absolute proof for anything to settle it. Old Cole draws endless plans of the house he intends to build when he gets home. Others figure up the cost of starting up a farm. July 23rd. Some fellows with a few tools are doing some fancy wood carving. McBride and Brzezinski are very good at it. The garden outside so far has only produced a few cucumbers. Cigarettes are still the principal means of barter or exchange in camp. One fag buys a bun, two or three a stew, half of one a sweet sauce or an issue of black China tea. Boys are beginning to play softball. Coots, George Coots Melva, is a patient up at Bourne Road. He was working on a fatigue party up there, and someone felled a tree on him. Several games of horseshoes are going on. July 25th. Prisoners for 7 months today. One of our men was charged with using vile language toward the staff sergeant of the Postal Corps. He got 7 days extra fatigue. An open-air concert on the square tonight. Alistair of Headquarters Brigade, is an accomplished mimic, really a scream in the Fred Allen radio broadcast. July 26, 42. Work party at the airfield, carrying sacks full of mud between two men, swung on a bamboo pole, 350 paces to the seawall and dumping in the harbor. Trudging through mud and water that often comes over our boot tops. Kit Koski is carving out a set of chessmen. Sergeant McCarthy is doing some fine woodwork. July 27th, Fisher and Ward are doing a flourishing business manufacturing sandals of wood, belting, leather, or old tires for the officers. July 28th, more rain. Sentry stationed in the newly built watchtowers amuse themselves with firing at any Chinese fishing craft that ventures close. Searchlights probing the clouds tonight with long white fingers. July 29th, a boisterous wind, white caps in the bay. The fishing fleet is drifting in, wallowing deeply as they come. Two small sampans are swamped in the waves. Heavy squalls of rain throughout the day. Typhoon warming up again tonight. Usual colored lights in the high towers. July 30th, cloudy, but wind abating. All the Chinese fishing fleet of sampans and junks is heading out to the open sea again, tacking back and forth against the wind. August 1st, more rain. A lance corporal is up in orders because he skipped a PT parade. He was stripped and reduced to the ranks. A new and smaller scoop is used to dish out the rice tonight. Another man got detention for talking back to an NCO. The Japs have telephones rigged to the watchtowers now. Martin fainted in a roll call today. Birch, Al Birch, is holding forth in a theological declamation on Revelations, but Britain, or Breton, is not taking him very seriously. Murray and Weir have constructed a curious stringed instrument and are producing some weird sounds from it. Some confirmed gamblers who have a craze for card playing are playing for their dinners, trying to play all night by the light in the washroom, but the Japs suddenly chased them out. Our skins are drying up and cracking and peeling, since there's no fat in our diet whatever. A lot of men have sore mouths due to the lack of vitamins. Lucas sent to Bourne Road with an infected throat, a very bad case. August 8th, a concert in the square. Ed Taves masquerading as a Russian countess. Willis of Yorkton sang, a stunned voice. August 9th, very hot, terrible thirst, taking a shower 3 times a day. Japs still engaged in salvaging sunken ships around here. We hear the nursing sisters at Bourne Road will be sent to the Stanley internment camp. August 10th, a lot of wounded Japs coming into Kowloon and filling up St. Teresa's Hospital. August 12th, there's a lot of skin trouble in camp owing to our diet, which is now nothing but starch. The working party the last 3 days have been cutting grass on the airfields on hands and knees with a sickle. The ration party that went out and across the Kowloon side report a big warehouse full of tons of flour and sugar. August 14th, old Cole has erysipelas, his face swollen and bluish. Old Jim Chapman sent to Bourne Road with Quincy. Hear that diphtheria is raging in Champchapeau. The losing man approximately every day, total of 15 today. Only one case here yet, but we were warned to keep to our own areas. No mixing with the Royal Rifles. No more games, no classes, no battalion parades. August 15th, a Jap gunboat passed our camp. And sweet potatoes were grown locally, but we got very few of them. But actually, when we saw the Japs harvesting their rice, they were beating out the heads with a flail. They had no mechanized machinery. The rice plants were pulled out by the roots and had hung head down on open walls or wooden frameworks, which were made after a lattice fashion about 30 feet long and 20 feet high. The last summer in Japan, we had a camp bath fixed up for us, made of plank, held about 50 men at one time. It was electrically heated, and at one time there was a short somewhere, and we got quite a shock getting into water. The Japs had a small brown bowl made of some plastic material, and it was a standard measure for dishing out our rations, whether the meal was rice or barley or milk seed or a fine yellow substance known as awa. The server would get the wooden bucket on the ground between his knees, and using a wooden paddle, he would pack the steaming mixture in a small brown bowl and level it off. There might be a small dipper of straw to go with it, or a piece of salty yellow daikon pickle or two spoonfuls of grasshoppers. If the server saw he was going to be short, the crowd would go forth, hold on to your rice, and the server would have to go around with a spoon and collect a spoonful from each or more until he'd made up the ration that he was short. In order to eat heavily for the present, some fellows would have the meals traded off for weeks ahead. Eventually, they got in so deep, they had everything going out and nothing coming in. The major made the man turn in a statement of their indebtedness and laid down a routine whereby they could pay off a meal a day. They were sternly forbidden to do any more trading. This didn't work as they continued trading, so the doctor took a hand. He ordered them to report to the hospital. He had their meal served there and washed the meat so they could not carry anything out to trade. They are known as the Eight Ball Club. Labor was so scarce that gangs of convicts were put to work on the docks close to us. They wore straw sandals, night blue flimsy cotton coat and trousers and caps. They were the most depraved, degenerate-looking specimens I ever saw, all bent over, fear, cunning, suspicion, and hatred all written over their faces. And they were treated brutally. Their guards wore a fancy black uniform carrying a long sword, smug and complacent, drunk with power, childishly eager to show off in front of us and demonstrate the power of life and death over their miserable victims. The biggest men I ever saw in Japan were a gang of Chinese POWs. They could carry more than any Jap and still seemed to have some spirit. They had not been entirely broken. We received two Red Cross parcels while in Hong Kong in 42. They were from the British Red Cross and were like manna from heaven. I was in Bowen Road Military Hospital at the time, and Jack Hardy and I each put on a pound a day while eating the first box. We made it last 7 days. While in Japan, 43 to 45, we received 4 1/7 American Red Cross parcels. They were very good and a wonderful help to us. We often wondered what the Canadian parcels must have been like. I'd like to take this opportunity of paying a tribute to Freddie Drover of Newfoundland. He was the finest medical orderly we ever had. The only orderly who never lost his patience or his temper. He never lost hope and always did his best to inspire it in others. We put on a few entertainments in our camp in Japan. Two Americans, Bill Barber and George France, were largely responsible for the concerts. Anyone of 5B will not soon forget the two plays, Edie Was a Lady, nor Romeo and Juliet. The Bard of Avon might have been profoundly shocked if he could have heard Romeo borrowing Hamlet's speeches But an audience of POWs was not critical. The Jap camp staff enjoyed the third act, the Viti was a lady, so well they ordered it repeated a second time. Was it only a rumor that the camp commandant was disappointed when he discovered that Edie was no lady, but only Sergeant Neal masquerading as one? What would the commandant have thought if he could have seen Sonny Castro in the Bayadeers at Shamshapol? The first V-29s we ever saw over Niigata were so high they were just like a meteor streak, only the long vapor streams that followed them being clearly discernible. Half a dozen come over at different times in the spring of 45, taking pictures, I presume. Then in the summer, they started coming over at night, dropping mines in the harbor, even dropped some on dry land. When they came over at night, all the searchlights in the countryside went on. All the ACAC opened up, and we were chased out of camp up on a high hill where a few foxholes had been dug and were kept there until morning. We only saw one B-29 shot down in flames. One forenoon, the summer of 45, we're on the Maroosa docks working on the American side. The donkey engines or winches that work the cable, swing booms, and nets that unload the cargo were out of order, so we had to climb down in the hold, load up the bags of rice in our backs, carry them up the ladder, drop them on the deck, while others carried them in the warehouse. I was one of the dozen in the hold when the air siren went. Our foreman, old Sibusan, at the time, it was Sibusan, would not let us out of the hold until he had sighted the plane. By the time that we gained the deck, they were right over us. There were American fighters. Some said there was 15, some said there was 20. I didn't wait to count. They were after a gunboat in the harbor, about a half mile from us. She opened up with everything she had on board, and the noise was deafening. She had too hot for them, and they sheered away. Then came back and strafed along the dockside, sunk about 100 yards from one we're working on. Inside our warehouse, an officer had a squad of soldiers to draw up attention. When the planes dove on the gunboat, when the first deafening burst of gunfire smote their ears, the squad scattered like leaves before the wind. The officer was left alone, waving his arms, his shouted commands drowned by the pandemonium outside, and unheard and disregarded by his panic-stricken man, it was the only comic note in the whole situation. We had two Jap foremen for a long time, Kobayasan, or Squeaky, and Sato-san, or the little monkey. Squeaky was a lazy, conceited, and mean. He loved to sit close to a glowing charcoal brazier, over which he had placed in a well-sheltered spot, and toast dried fish over the coals and munch these toasted soybeans. Excuse me. While we worked out in the wind, digging tiger iron out of the snow and loading it in the cars, he delighted in cutting out our kamane soup at the slightest excuse. How he relished the phrase, "Osta supanoda." Tomorrow there will be no soup. He rolled it over his tongue like a sweet morsel, and his wicked little eyes glittered with malice. His idea of company soup was daikon tops or greens boiled up. The other foreman would scrounge for our company soup, potatoes or fish or sometimes a little flour, or let us dig up and take to the shack a few of the millions of sprouting soybeans along the track. These had sprouts which were about 2 inches long and are quite edible and rich in vitamins. Sato-san, the little monkey, was one of the most active foremen we ever saw. We used to say all he needed was a tail, and any zoo would be glad to get him. But he was a hard worker and was never happy unless the gang was working at top speed. He loved to shout, "Speedo, speedo, haiku, haiku," at the line of cart men trotting past him. Unlike Squeaky, he was always ready to lend a hand at stacking bags in a warehouse or packing the last pair of bags in the top of a freight car in a confined space. He was a wizard at that because he was so small and yet so very muscular. Like all coolies who had worked on the docks all their life, he was an adept at using the hooks with which they handled all the bags and used in other countless ways. Many men were unable to stand the gaff on account of illness and undernourishment. If a man was slow, it was a cardinal sin in the eyes of Sato-san. He would puff out his cheeks and glare venomously while he fairly spat out the words, "Throw, throw, dummy, dummy." He would strip to the waist, though, and work inside a hot car until the sweat rolled off him while Squeaky strutted around. Kobayashi strutted around with his hands in his pockets. All the lame and the halt were put in the Gizzy Gang. That's what the Japs called it, the Gizzy Gang, which might be put to work at odd jobs when they're not in shape to carry bags of beans. Although even some couldn't carry, kept busy sweeping up loose beans or shoveling them into straw sacks or carrying drinking water or pulling or rolling sacks down from the top of the pile or keeping tally with the mumbo sticks. This latter is one of the most primitive customs. Each time a bag of beans went through the door, one man would take a stick, a small hardwood stick about an inch and a half wide by 6 inches long, out of one box and hand it to someone else who gravely placed it in another box. These were hardwood sticks, flat hardwood sticks, and they always had a Japanese design burned into them with hot iron. A character, a Japanese character burned into these with a hot iron. But as a rule, this job, the mumbo sticks, was handled by the Japs or the coolie girls. One heavy, dangerous job was unloading large packing cases full of paper. I never knew paper could be so heavy in the boat. One of our men, Carl Jonsson, was badly crippled by a falling case. Struck his knee. We also loaded tons of fertilizer, and once we were issued out in the docks a watermelon each, and one of the Americans shouted, "What's the offer for my slice of watermelon?" And there was a moment's silence, and he said, "I sprinkled salt on it," and instantly three fellows yelled, "What do you want for the salt?" First, Satasan was called up from the army, and a few months later, Kobayashi-san was called up from the army. He really cleaned out the shack when he went. He'd been accumulating some large reserves of beans, rice, and flour in his compartment in our mess shack. There was snow on the ground, I remember the day he left, for he had a big load and a small wooden hand sleigh, and he made two of our men move it for him. The coolies who worked on the docks really lived well, as they had access unofficially to all the foodstuffs which came in or went out. And you never saw a dock laborer, male or female, going home at night without something wrapped up in their apron. All wore aprons during work, canvas on the outside and some soft material on the inside. Whenever they were carrying anything, they had the apron over their head and shoulders for protection. When handling pig iron, it tied around their waist. The stackers carrying the rice sacks in the docks were very short and very heavily built. These women that worked on the docks were very short and heavily built, and they were, I'm sure they were stronger than we were. Of course, they were better fed. They were better fed. The old Seba-san was an odd character, even for Jap. He wore glasses, a bushy black beard, and had two gold, actually they looked like brass, two gold teeth in his upper front, then a silver tooth, then two more gold. His favorite expression when enraged was "Demerica, Demerica," or "this, this." His common, ordinary, everyday cuss words were the same as Satasan's and Kobayashi-san's. "Bacaro" or "Conero." That was Japanese profanity. "Bacaro" and "Conero." That was some foul language. We never found out what it meant. But they used it in us all the time. But, actually, Seba-san took a queer sort of personal pride in his gang, in us, in fact. He bragged to the other warehousemen or to the Marutso office staff about how much work we did. When we had so many cars of rice to load down at Marishang's,
warehouse, and we ran up and down that plank. We finished in record time. He fairly beamed. He beamed. When canned milk powder was stolen from a warehouse, and a search proved that we at least had none on our person or in our haversack or in our mess kit at the time, but several of the Spanish boys among the Yanks did have some, Sebastian fairly glowed with delight. We were his white-haired boys on that one momentous occasion at least. He searched us first, sick at heart, angry and sorry at the same time. And when he found nothing, he was flabbergasted, incredulous, amazed, but oh, so relieved, and so happy. His solemn, confidential warning, accompanied by sober head shaking for days afterwards, was, "Steal old dummy dummy. Sagoto talks on, Sabbath talks on. Steal old talks on, Sabbath new. Stick many, many. Okay?" Which, being interpreted in a broad, literal way, meant, "It is very hard to steal. If you work hard, we'll give you something for it. If you steal, we'll give you nothing, but beat you many times. Do you understand?" That's a broad, literal interpretation to our interpreter. The only expression of ours which the Japs picked up was okay. It spread like wildfire. Even the urchins in the streets shouted after us. Okay. Our other foreman, Sigga Harrison, or Henry as we call him, was the one comic among all the Japs. He was a very pompous individual who took himself very seriously and yet seemed to be one of the few Japs who had a bit of a sense of humor. He was a regular parrot. If an English sentence was repeated to him three or four times, he could repeat it quite readily and pronounce the words, a thing extremely difficult for the average Jap. If Henry could have dreamed of the meaning of the lurid phrases he was taught, or realized how he was defaming himself, his origin, and his habits when he glibly repeated them on all occasions when he had an audience, he might not have been so pleased when we went into gales of laughter. I have heard plenty of the boys say that they never want to see or taste rice again, but if I had it the way my mother used to prepare it with milk and eggs and sugar and spice and raisins, I'd enjoy it too. Food and freedom are the two main topics of conversation over there. Some fellows collected recipes and raved about what they would eat when they got home. One long, lean Yank from the Arkansas Mountains said he hoped he'd be home in time for Thanksgiving. When asked what he'd have, he said, "Bear meat and beans." The Christmas of 44-45 was a great improvement over the year before. The day was declared a holiday. Each man received an American Red Cross parcel, and some mail came in. I received a letter from my brother John. It was only a year old. It had a photo in it. The only photo I received while a prisoner of war. It was a photo of my brother's wife and their two little boys sitting beside their decorated Christmas tree. I really got a lump in my throat. Everyone around wanted to see the picture. If one man looked at it, I'll bet 50 did. The kitchen had been hoarding up a few extras to give us a good meal on Christmas. Along with the parcel, I'm sure everyone was full for once. We had a concert, and it was one of the best English concerts held in Japan, we think. Red Barlow's Little Red Riding Hood, in the play of the same name, brought down the house when he cried in a shrill falsetto to the wolf in the bed. But, Grandma, you've got a nose just like Humicky's. Well, Humicky was one of our men who had a tremendous proboscis. As I recall correctly, the last day we ever worked on Moosa Docks was the 18th of August. That morning, on our way out to work, a B-29 went over at a great height, dropping millions of leaflets. It looked like snowflakes fluttering down. The air currents would take a great swirl of them off in one direction and then back again.
They began to fall several hundred yards ahead of us. The Jap civilians were picking them up and reading them. Then, when they saw us, they began tearing them up. Our guards running back and forth along the sides of the column to make sure we did not pick any out, but one of the boys managed to, and when we reached camp at night, we got a hold of our interpreter and learned that Russia was in the war. Then we were put to work carrying in large green, evergreen logs from the pine forest that covered the sand hills behind the camp. A few days of that, and we ceased work except for camp fatigues. On August 23rd, we got a new camp commandant, very clever to spirit away the old one before things broke wide open. The Imperials nearly mobbed Major Fellows, the American major who ran the camp under Jap jurisdiction, because our rations were so small. A huge sign about 20 feet by 30 feet was wrecked on the hill behind the camp. Black and orange lettered POW for identification by aircraft. At 20 to 9 on August the 25th, 1945, a flight of American planes flew over our camp, circled, wheeled, dived, and rolled. 11 Sikorskis, one Grumman fighter. We all crowded in the square and waved our hands and yelled our heads off. It was a time of great rejoicing. We felt we were almost free. That afternoon, two different flights came over. Dropped toilet articles, cigarettes, chocolates, books, magazines. Thereafter, every second or third day, the B-29s began to come over, opening their bomb bays, would vomit forth 40-gallon steel drums full of food supplies. Sometimes they'd be in twos, the bombs welded together. Far too often, they broke away from the parachutes and dropped like a stone, and when they hit the ground, they crumbled up like paper. It was maddening to see tomato juice sprayed all over the ground. At times, the dropping of supplies were actually dangerous. A Japanese woman, 200 yards outside the camp, was struck by a case of canned peaches. Sergeant Neal said it was the best thing that ever hit her, but it killed the poor woman. One of our men saw a drum dropping through the treetops. He leaped right out of his wooden sandals and ran. When he went back to look for his sandals, they were underneath the drum. One pilot dropped a bale right through the very center of the big POW sign. But several bales crashed to the roof of our hut. and some dropped the loads as far away as a half mile from camp. We had to form a picket line around the outskirts of the area to keep the Jap civilians away. Most of the planes flew too low and did not give the chats a chance to open. But the ones who flew high and judged accurately provided a wonderful spectacle when the chats opened and slowly drifted down their beautiful sight, their white and blue and red and green. This was dropped into our prison camp from American planes. The Dutch submarine crew, yes. When the first planes came over, Major Fellows persuaded the Japanese interpreter to go with him to Tokyo and make arrangements for our camp to be evacuated. We really gorged on the supplies dropped to us, and we had American K-rations carried with us on our train trip. We left 5B forever on the night of September 5th, and when we left our camp, the guards were still armed, and the nearest Americans were many, many miles away. We rode in trucks to a lonely part of the railroad, far from any station, and still a small, curious crowd collected out of nowhere. During the 4 years that I was away, I received about a dozen communications. Most were issued to us after the war was over, and we were waiting in camp for our release. Some had been held up for many months. After I reached home and my 40 days leave was half over, I received a parcel from my parents which had been sent to me in 41. It had reached Japan as it had Japanese characters stamped on it. My brother Jim looked over the contents. He had helped pack them. Well, he remarked, it's been strafed. The chocolate bars and the soap are gone. It had evidently lain out on the dock or in a leaky warehouse as the clothes, he put some underwear in, as the clothes are quite musty. Later on, I got a Christmas card from Mackenzie King, dated 1943. When we quit work on the docks and before the first planes dropped anything into camp, naturally, the wildest rumors were rife, and I scribbled this down. When we shake the dust of Nippon from each shoe, and our days of long sagotoing are through, sagoto was work. When Marutsu docks are fading out of view, and we're eating yes and drinking with the crew of the ship that's sailing home across the blue, then perhaps we'll realize this news is true. It was one of the Middlesex on the train to Tokyo who quoted Kipling's, "Trooping, trooping, trooping to the sea. Here's September come again, the six-year men are free. We must leave the dead behind us, for they cannot come away. To where the ships are calling up that takes us home today. We're going home, we're going home. Our ship is on the shore, and you must pack your haversack, for we won't come back no more. Oh, don't you cry for me, my lovely Marianne, for I'll marry you yet on a fourpenny bit as a time-expired man." September 5th, 45. Tonight we're leaving this camp forever. A lot of the men have been trading off their blankets and their old clothes to the Japs down in the village for sake. Moonshine Moonahan, he was one of the Yanks, is dancing, shouting, and giving his famous imitation of a train whistle. The one-time model camp for cleanliness, discipline, and order presents a startling contrast. So much food was dropped from the air, the ground is littered with tins, empty, of course, boxes, cardboard, paper, rubbish carried about, men shouting, singing, and staggering about. For once, the first time, the Jap guard is very quiet, modest, and self-effacing. No more strutting or swaggering. At 8 o'clock tonight, clad in our new raiment dropped from the air, we climbed into buses and drove to the nearest railway track. No station, not even a siding. Just a lonely stretch of track. Before the last truck left, our bugler played the last post. We waited in the dark by the track for a good hour. We are carrying dry K rations and the can of fruit juice, all dropped from the air. We rode all night, very cramped, never slept a wink. As dawn broke, we neared the vast area of ruins that was once Tokyo. We changed to an electric train at 7:30, and many men in
the phase was the big phase between before we
in an exuberant mood through chewing gum and bars and chocolate bars at every pretty face they saw near the track. They finally reached Yokohama at 8:30. Got a thrill when he saw the first American troops, sentries posted, MPs, and most marvelous of all, white women, American Red Cross nurses. They actually looked like angels. A great day. We piled in the trucks and rode for 5 miles, saw engineers at work, big cats, bulldozers leveling ruins, reached the docks and heard a large warehouse fixed up by the Red Cross, saw more nurses, and a long counter piled high with golden donuts and steaming cups of hot coffee. I ate more than I should. I spoke to a Red Cross nurse, Miss Opha Thompson of Belmont, Iowa. Our group was called away, so we had to go. Our kits were sprayed and disinfected. We had a good shower, filled out a long questionnaire, name, age, and ailments, etc. Then we had an X-ray through a long line of doctors who checked us on most points, filled out another questionnaire, and sent a wireless home to our people. Major McDougall, a Canadian officer who took our pictures. Then we climbed into trucks, rode 5 miles, and climbed down into Higgins boats, a powerful motorized barge, square across each end. We covered about 3 miles in a smother of foam, leaving behind at the docks two big, white, beautiful hospital ships, the U.S. Marigold and the U.S. Benevolence. And their brass were just shone like gold. And their hulls were painted white as snow. And every other ship was a dull, drab, dirty, gray blue. And those hospital ships just stood out so plain. And one fellow said, I'd like to go home in that hospital ship. And another fellow said, I'd go home on a raft if that was the only way. He said, I'm not worrying about the hospital ship. And just the men who were extremely ill, who were in stretchers, were taken aboard the hospital ship. But we reached the Ozark, a transport for troop and vehicles, regular cruiser hull, a crew of 450 capable of carrying 800 troops, armed with 5 5-inch guns, 8 40-millimeter guns, and 4 20-millimeter guns, built in 41. Saw action off New Guinea, where she took off 1,000 wounded Marines. She is 460 feet long. We filled out another questionnaire as soon as we boarded her, then given a ticket which showed us to our berth. We sleep on hanging shelves, one above the other, 4 feet high. At 3 o'clock, we had ice cream served us. It seemed as though nothing ever tasted so good. When supper came around, it seemed too good to be true. We had meat potatoes and salad and spinach bread, pie, jam, oranges, hot cocoa. Saw a talkie movie in the upper deck, went to bed and slept like the dead on a clean white sheets and white fluffy pillows. September 7th, wonderful breakfast. American Navy lived like kings. Bread, butter, bacon, hot cakes, so rich, so light, so fluffy, they melt in your mouth, and coffee and oranges. Where we are anchored inside a breakwater, the sea is almost as smooth as glass. Only tiny surface ripples. Yesterday was very hot. Today is cooler. Quite a heavy mist. Conditions on the Ozark are almost ideal. No fatigues, no officers, no PT. The drinking water is ice cold and of excellent quality. Most of the ships wear blue denim trousers. Most of the ship's crew wear blue denim trousers, faded from many washings. No one's allowed to wear shorts in the upper deck. This afternoon at 3, served with ice cream, an apple, and an orange. Tonight in the show, there was a sports review of Eastern Canada. Saw the Kelties, heard a pipe band of the Highland Regiment, saw Canadian Mounties, brought a lump into my throat to see them marching in a parade to the bagpipes. September 8th, 45. Two Canadian officers just out from Canada are here. The boys bombarded them with questions, so I think they're glad to go ashore. Today the ship was underway, head for Guam, 1,400 miles away. Sunday, September 9th.
a Catholic service in the upper deck, but it rained. Cleared up for the Protestant service later. Chicken Maryland style for dinner. Delicious. September 12th, 45. We sighted the island of Guam about 5 o'clock this morning. Reached the pier about 7. A great deal of activity here. Ships loading and unloading. Trucks of every size, some monsters. Racing here and there. Caterpillars, bulldozers, etc. all busy. We left the ship and climbed into trucks and buses and drove for miles over a splendid, hard, wide, smooth road which had a continual stream of traffic running both ways. Past hundreds of Quonset huts, cheap, quickly put together, fine for hot, dry weather, but no good for the heavy rainstorms which are raging now. The rain drives in the windows which run on the full length of the hut and have no glass, only wire screening. This is on Guam. We are getting a thorough medical checking up and a general examination. The food here is wonderful and all you can possibly eat. I wrote an air mail letter home today. September 13th. The rains continue. Quonset huts are leaking. Tonight, Charlie Ruggles in person and Mary Bryan, a cast not so well known, put on a show in the mess hall. It's very funny. I asked Charlie for his autograph, which he gave me quite willingly, but forgot to ask me for mine. He was in a hurry, anyway. September 14th. Windy, rainy weather. Paid $5 for the American Red Cross. September 15th. Last night, we filled out a long questionnaire on war crimes. Now we're getting a form filled out for clearing us from the island. Tonight, we boarded the Ozark again. September 16th. Tied up the wharf all day. I'm already paid for its boarding. Boat packed at capacity. Weather hot. The island of Guam is 28 miles long and 6 wide. Native is dark brown in color. September 25th, 45. Pulled into Pearl Harbor today. There was a colored band on the dock playing Hail, Hail, the Gang's All Here. A dozen American officers. 3 or 4 white women. One with a little girl, about 2 years old. A clown in costume with huge flapping feet whose favorite trick was pulling ladies' lingerie out of sailors' blouses. A whack or wave was looking everywhere for her brother among our ship's personnel. Finally found him, a Russian, Mike Sofronoff. 2 American women met 2 very dear friends after what it must have been a long separation. One lady hung 4 layers or flower wreath around her lover's neck. It looked kind of silly to me, but he didn't seem to mind it. I just saw a Benson who hangs them on you. They went off arm in arm, and we all heaved a deep sigh. The Marines were allowed off the ship an hour before us. We were issued new uniforms and another $50 in pay. They were given $100 at Guam. So they bought out the nearby stand of all its pineapple juice. When we got off, there was nothing left, so we went back to the ship. The show tonight was Donald Duck. September the 26th, 45. There are a lot of ships here in Pearl Harbor, many anchored, others coming and going continually. A big aircraft carrier across the bay. Our crew are all in white, lined up for inspection. Look like penguins. Planes seem to be in the air continually, all sizes and models. We have a huge streamer floating from the top of the mainmast. It is a star for every officer on board and a foot in length for every member of the crew. It is red, white, and blue in color and is borne aloft by 5 large balloons. It serves as an announcement to all and sundry that we are homeward bound. 2 wonderful words. A large Canadian hospital ship is anchored near the Letitia. She left Halifax September 1st, supposed to be going to Manila. 12 noon, pulling out, bound for Frisco. Should make it in 5 days. October 2nd, 45. A dense fog this morning. First sight of the buoy with a bell on the top that tolled dismally. Then a coast patrol boat. More channel buoys and finally the dim outlines of the Golden Gate Bridge. Then shortly after we passed under the huge span, a ferry with about 200 beautiful girls aboard, a band playing California, Here I Come, a big banner on the side, Welcome Home, came craning alongside. The girls all waving like mad. Ship docked at noon. Huge crowd, 2 bands, played the Star Spangled Banner first, then O Canada. Many joyful meetings. About 1,000 Americans left the ship right there. But we were not allowed to set foot in the dock. About 2, we disembarked onto a ferry, which took us across the bay to Fort McDowell on Angel Island, supposed to be the oldest U.S. Army post in existence. We climbed the steep hill to barracks, fell in, and got paid $20 per man. A speech from the Adjutant General of Canada. Then, an excellent supper. I drank 4 large cups of milk. Italian prisoners of war are working in the kitchen mess hall here. They look very fat, greasy, and happy. They have all they can eat and are paid 60 cents a day in American money. Tonight we saw a horror show with Boris Karloff, a bit of a newsreel showing the Allied occupation of Hong Kong. Slept well in spite of the foghorn blowing continuously out in the harbor. October 3rd, splendid breakfast, all the milk we could drink. Eggs, pineapple jam, a set of fresh fruit, both pears and apples. This forenoon, the amplifier is broadcasting a game between Detroit and Chicago. The latter won 9-0. I sent a few postcards home. Excellent dinner, beefsteak, ice cream, etc. The only effect the good food had on most of our men aboard the Ozark were crossing the Pacific. Our legs and our feet became swollen. Our feet were so big we couldn't get our boots on. We went to the ship's doctor, and what a dressing down we got from him. You see, we fell in after the crew, naturally, and we had our meal. We came out again, and we fell in again. We were eating 6 meals a day on board the Ozark. 6 meals a day. And all that happened was our feet and our legs swole up. Our feet were just huge. They were tremendous. And the ship's doctor, was he ever wild? He said, you're going to cut out this heavy eating, or you're going to be put in the brig. He said, you're not going to gorge like that. And that's exactly what happened. I'm just telling you exactly what happened. After dinner, we boarded the ferry and crossed the bay under the Oakland Bridge. It has heavy traffic, trains, streetcars, and motor cars. Reached shore and found a train waiting. It pulled out 5, regular Pullman, Negro porters, diners, hospital cars, air conditioning. Windows must be kept closed or won't function. Roast turkey for supper, Pullman bed is certainly comfortable, clean white sheets, deep soft mattress. October 4th, heading due north. Snow-covered peaks on either hand, into a country of rolling hills, heavily timbered at first, dwindling into level plains and finally farmland. There's a long train, 18 coaches, reach Klamath Falls about 9. On the sidings through the string of flat cars loaded high with huge logs. Out in the farmlands again, the combines working in the fields, now passing through a chain of lakes on either side into the hills covered with jack pine. When we saw Mount Shasta, we had left California and entered Oregon. Passed through quite a number of tunnels, saw another large lake, some splendid timber, deep gorges, vast canyons far below, more tunnels, I count 8 so far, some huge peaks rung up beyond the canyon. At one stop in Oregon, we're only a dozen yards from an apple orchard, a lot of fruit on the ground beneath the trees. Jenkins and I almost persuaded Red Barlow to raid the orchard for us. We pushed him off the train and carried him with threats until he was at the fence when a large dog came up and showed his teeth and Barlow lost heart. All right, October 5th, 45. We pulled into Seattle about 6 this morning, climbed off and boarded the Princess Alice for Victoria, docked at noon, tremendous ovation. Piled on buses, drove out to Gordon Head Camp. About 4 miles, issued with uniforms, kit, etc. Wired home. October 6th, dashing here and there all over camp today, getting badges, flashes, ribbons, and a long lineup for our medical examinations. They even took our fingerprints and our photos. A big crowd waiting in the tailor shop to flash its own battle dress blouses. While I was waiting there, who should walk in but Ewing McLaren, my second cousin, and Robert Harper, whom I used to go to school with at Paramount. It was great to see someone from near home. We talked for several hours. Then Millis and I went to the canteen and drank milk and listened to one of the Red Cross volunteers play the piano. October 7th, roll call in the drill hall, checked our kits, took buses at 10, drove to park, marched the dock. Met Robert Harper and his wife again. They gave me a very tasty lunch and a number of issues of the Rest and Recorder, the old local paper. So I got caught up on a little news, though much of it was mystifying. It's hard to bridge the gap made by 4 years. Boarded a ferry, good smooth sailing. Reached Vancouver about 5:30. Enormous crowd, band cheering. Met McSween. He had been with us in Jamaica, but he wasn't allowed to go to Hong Kong. Train waiting, crowd surging up and down alongside, hunting relatives, pulling out later, very tired. October 8th, we're in the Rockies, trees in all their glory of autumn color. A rushing mountain torrent zigzagging by, but always roughly parallel to the track. It is shallow now and rocky, but swiftly flowing. The sun is setting now, we're in the foothills of Alberta. A great welcome at Calgary. A band, crowds, all auxiliaries of every denomination on the platform, donuts, coffee, chocolate bars. I wired ahead to Regina and to Kipling. Cousin Dave Forsyth, his wife and son, were on the platform bearing gifts when the train pulled into Regina. It was certainly good to see them. My aunt Florence, Uncle Tom, Lillian, Larry, and Betty Toppings were on the platform at Broadview. I could hardly believe my eyes the way the children had grown up. It was amazing. On to the train again, and speeding eastward. Each man has been issued a gallon can of condensed milk by the Red Cross. Bears the label, powdered high-protein milk supplement. We stopped for a few minutes at Elkhorn, and Big Tommy Thompson, the strongest man in the Royal Rifles, spying women on the platform. Spying a lady on the platform with two babies in a baby carriage, stepped off the train and dropped his can of milk into the baby carriage. "Lady, here's something for your babies," he said. The mother was so utterly astonished she could hardly thank him. It was dark when we pulled into Winnipeg. We said goodbye to Austin Roberts and Jimmy Webb and all the other rifles we've known so well. The rest is history. It's all in the papers next morning. Biggest crowd that ever jammed the station. The wildest, most excited mass of surging humanity I ever saw. The thrill, the joy, the heartfelt gratitude of being spared to meet my loved ones once again. My own family, my own friends, my neighbors. Kiss all the girls you can while you can was the sage advice of my brother Jim. In a couple of weeks' time, they will be slapping you again.